went through agony.
Nobody can break up a marriage that isn't broken to start with. We all know that.
I Remember You, this Saturday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of February. Good morning. This is Today with Simon Jack and Justin Webb.
The headlines this morning. An investigation has found that the deaths of at least 55 babies in 5 years could have been avoided with better maternity care at an NHS trust. And the Prime Minister says the billionaire co-owner of Manchester United, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, should apologise for claiming the UK has been colonised by immigrants.
Also in today's programme, the boss of Instagram has been in court in the US to defend claims that the company is damaging the mental health of young people. We'll hear a report from the courtroom.
It was a really big day. There were some people who were actually camped out overnight in the rain outside of the courthouse in order to be able to get a spot.
Plus, does the UK have a problem with the opioid nitazine? Experts think we do and say it's worse here than anywhere else in Europe. And...
It's the wrong trousers, Gromit, and they've gone wrong. Stop them, Gromit, stop them!
The new exhibition celebrates 50 years of the animation studio Aardman. Its co-founder, Peter Lloyd, will join us live. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
An investigation by BBC News and the New Statesman magazine has found at least 55 babies may have survived if they had received better maternity care at an NHS trust. The deaths occurred over a five-year period at the University Hospital's Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. The trust said safe maternity care was its goal, but it didn't always get this right. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
The Trust's internal assessments of the deaths over a five-year period from 2019 suggest that better care may have or was likely to have led to a different outcome in dozens of cases. The Trust paid out more to cover clinical negligence for maternity errors in 2024-25 than any trust in England that year. An independent investigation into its maternity service is also to be expanded. The University Hospital Sussex NHS Trust said their mortality levels for the last 3 years were markedly below the national average and they aimed to learn when things went wrong.
Sir Keir Starmer has called on one of the UK's richest men, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, to apologise for saying the country has been colonised by immigrants. The Prime Minister criticised the comments made by the Manchester United co-owner in an interview with Sky News. A Number 10 spokesperson said Sir Jim's words played into the hands of the people looking to divide the country. Our political correspondent Ben Wright reports.
It's not the first time Sir Jim Ratcliffe has waded into politics. An evangelist for Brexit, he then backed Labour at the last general election. But now the billionaire businessman who lives in the tax haven of Monaco has said politicians needed to do some difficult and unpopular things to get Britain back on track. He said the UK had been colonised by immigrants, remarks condemned by the Prime Minister. Sir Keir Starmer said they were offensive and wrong and that Britain was a proud, tolerant and diverse country. But the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, who Sir Jim called an intelligent man with good intentions, said the country had undergone unprecedented mass immigration that had changed the character of many areas. Mr Farage said Labour may try and ignore that, but Reform won't.
President Donald Trump says he has told Israel's prime minister that US negotiations will continue with Iran because he would prefer a deal to military action. His statement came at the end of talks with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. From Washington, here's our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
The two leaders spoke for nearly 3 hours in an unusually low-key meeting in which Mr. Netanyahu arrived out of view of the cameras and Mr. Trump held no press conference with him. Afterwards, the president said there was no definitive outcome, other than that he insisted that US negotiations with Iran continue to see whether or not a deal could, in his words, be consummated. He once again appeared to threaten military action if not. The Israeli leader is pressing Mr. Trump to ensure that any deal constrains Iran well beyond the nuclear issue, including limits to ballistic missile construction and withdrawing support for regional armed groups. The Iranian leadership has said its ballistic missiles are not up for discussion.
Police in Canada have identified the suspect in the fatal shooting of 8 people in British Columbia as 18-year-old Jessie Van Rootsela, a biological male who identified as female. A teacher and 5 pupils aged 12 and 13 were killed at Tumbler Ridge Secondary School. The suspect's mother and stepbrother were found dead at the family home. Jesse Van Rootseler also died from a self-inflicted wound. New figures show China's carbon dioxide emissions fell in 2025, the first full year to show such a decline. The analysis for the website Carbon Brief suggests the reduction is modest, just 0.3%, but campaigners say it raises hopes that emissions from the world's biggest polluter might be peaking ahead of schedule. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
This is not a dramatic breakthrough, but it means emissions from the world's manufacturing hub and second largest economy have now been flat or falling for almost 2 years. Carbon Brief's figures show a finely balanced picture. Emissions dropped across major sectors, including transport, power, cement and metals, but rose in the chemical industry. China also added more coal and gas-fired power capacity last year than in any year for a decade. The plants are intended to act as backup when wind and solar generation falls short, but are evidence that fossil fuels remain a key part of the country's energy system.
200 hospitality and leisure businesses are calling on ministers to abandon plans to allow a tax on overnight stays in England. The government is consulting on whether to give mayors and other local leaders permission to introduce a tourist tax or visitor levy to raise revenue. Here's our business reporter, Faria Massoud.
Leading companies in the hotel and tourism industry, including Butlins, Hilton, Travel Lodge and the owner of Alton Towers Theme Park, say the proposed tax could lead to people booking shorter holidays or going overseas and, in their words, draining money from local businesses. But the government says a levy would raise funds to improve local services. Some popular European destinations already have a tourist tax, including Rome, Paris and Berlin. Parts of Scotland will soon be introducing similar levies, while Manchester already has one in place, charging £1 per room. This has raised £2.8 million in its first year.
Football: Nottingham Forest have sacked Sean Dyche as head coach after less than 4 months in charge and are looking for their fourth manager of the season. Forest were held to a goalless draw at home by the bottom club Wolves last night and are just 3 points above the Premier League relegation zone with 12 games remaining.
Thanks, Jane. 7 minutes past six. Let us get some weather from Chris Fawkes. It's doing our heads in a bit, this weather, Chris. When is it going to change?
Do you know, Simon, I would start off with the revelation that Saturday looks like being a dry day with some sunshine for most of the UK. Before we get there, yeah, more of the same, more rain. We've got 82 flood warnings currently in force. The majority of these across parts of Dorset, Wiltshire and Somerset. And because a lot of it is due to groundwater flooding, there'll be little overall change in that weather picture over the next few days with further flooding concerns expected. Now, weather-wise today, most of us will see outbreaks of rain with low pressure firmly in charge. It is turning colder from the north today as well. Diving into the detail, England and Wales, a cloudy start with outbreaks of rain. There are a few mist and fog patches around. A few bright spells are possible for a time across southeast England. And later this afternoon, you might also see the weather improve across parts of southwest England and southern Wales with some afternoon sunshine, a few isolated showers. But otherwise, it's cloudy with rain, cold enough for a bit of sleet over the tops of the northern Pennines, the Cheviots as well, as we go through the day. Our temperatures, quite a range, 7 or 8 degrees northern England and the Midlands. For southern parts of England and Wales, we're looking at highs of 10 to 12, so it will be a mild day. For Northern Ireland, cloudy with rain. Some of the rain quite heavy for western counties today. Temperatures here around about 4 to 6 Celsius with little sign of improvement in the weather. For Scotland, quite a mixture of weather today. A lot of cloud around with rain, some sleet over hills. And for the north of Scotland, we'll see some brighter weather for the north of Highland, Hebrides, Orkney and Shetland with sunshine and a few showers. Might be brighter across the north of Scotland, but it's cold. Just 3 degrees in Lerwick. Otherwise, temperatures around 4 to 6 Celsius overnight tonight. We're looking at a spell of hill snow for Scotland and across the Pennines, which could bring some tricky travelling conditions into Friday morning. That's latest.
Chris, thank you. 8 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Express leading on comments made by Sir Jim Ratcliffe, quoting him in its headline. The UK colonised by migrants, claims United Chief. The Daily Star focuses on the reaction to his statement. Man U, Jim, racism storm is its headline. The Daily Mirror calls Mr Ratcliffe shameful, citing figures from the Office for National Statistics. The Times says the billionaire's suggestion that the UK's population has increased by 12 million people since 2020 is wrong, noting the figure is close to 3 million.
The Prime Minister is coming coming under increasing pressure to appoint a woman as his de facto deputy and end Number 10's boys' club days. According to The Guardian, one of the party's most senior figures, Harriet Harman, has called on Sir Keir Starmer to revive the role of First Secretary of State, a post previously held by Peter Mandelson and under Gordon Brown.
The Sun claims that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was lent £12 million by his parents and his brother Charles to pay a settlement to Virginia Giuffre, who accused the former prince of sexual abuse. Quoting an unnamed source, it adds that he has not paid back a penny. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has always denied any wrongdoing.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has said she's up for taking Britain closer to the EU, according to the Daily Telegraph. Speaking at an event in London, Ms. Reeves said closer relations represented the biggest prize for the economy. The report notes that this is a significant shift from comments she made in Davos last month when the Chancellor said Britain could not go back in time in its relationship with the EU.
The Financial Times says shares in Britain's largest wealth managers tumbled yesterday, the drop coming after the US-based firm launched a new AI tool to help financial advisers with clients' investment strategies, according to the paper.
And the Metro leads on a warning from the Shadow Transport Secretary, Richard Holden, who says fare dodgers are harming the UK. The paper says his comments came after a man who used trains for 2 years without buying a ticket, totalling £3,600 in free journeys, was spared prison. Jammy Dodger reads the headline.
6:10 is the time.
An investigation by the BBC News and the New Statesman magazine has found at least 55 babies may have survived if they'd received better maternity care at one of the largest hospital trusts in southeast England. Michael Buchanan, our social affairs correspondent, is on the line. 55 is a very stark number, Michael.
It is. Good morning. This is the University Hospital Sussex, which runs four hospitals in the south of England, including in Brighton and Worthing, for instance. And working with the New Statesman, we've been looking into the maternity care over a number of years. Now, in June, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, announced that there would be a limited review into maternity concerns into 9 cases. But what we have found is that the concerns are more widespread. Those 55 deaths that you referred to took place over a 5-year period between 2019 and 2023. These are analyses that were done by the trust itself that say that the deaths may have or were likely to have been improved. The outcomes would have been improved had they received better care. We've also learned that there was a review of 9 stillbirths at Worthing Hospital between 2021 and 2022, for instance, that found there were missed opportunities in all of those cases, and also that external advisors had external investigators had warned the trust about what's called a normal birth culture, which is a creed that operated in the NHS for a number of years that promoted vaginal deliveries with minimal medical intervention, and the external investigators say that this was causing concern at this particular trust.
And have the trust itself responded at all?
Yes, so they say that they are they strive to provide the best and safest maternity care. They say that their mortality rates for the past 3 years have been markedly below national average rates for England, and the chief executive says that they acknowledge, however, that they didn't always get this right, this being maternity care, and they say that this upcoming review, which we understand is going to be expanded to at least 15 cases, they hope that that will answer the family's questions and will drive further improvements in the maternity services at University Hospital Sussex.
Michael, thank you. Michael Buchanan, our social affairs correspondent. And we're going to be talking to Katie Fowler, the mother of Abigail Fowler Miller, who died just 2 days old at in the Brighton's Royal Sussex County Hospital. We're talking to them about 7:30.
6:13 is the time now. The authorities in Canada have been saying more about the killer who murdered 8 people in a remote community in British Columbia. Our reporter, Simi Jola Osho.
The Canadian police have told us a bit more about the suspect who is called Jesse Van Rootseller and was 18 years old. The suspect attended Tumbler Ridge Secondary School but dropped out of the school about 4 years ago. The police described them as born as a biological male who approximately 6 years ago began to transition to female, and also mentioned that the police had a history of attending Van Rootseller's family residence. Many of the calls were related to mental health issues, and Van Rootseller had been apprehended at one point to be assessed under the Mental Health Act. We still don't know what the suspect's motives were, When asked if Van Rietselen had faced bullying because of their gender identity, the Deputy Commissioner, Dwayne MacDonald, said there was no suggestion that that was the case.
Meanwhile, the awful business of this tiny community coming to terms with what has happened begins, but presumably in just desperate circumstances.
Yeah, this is truly shocking for this remote town that has a population of less than 3,000. And even this shooting is one of the deadliest school shootings in Canada's history. We have seen some video coming out of Tumbler Ridge of people coming together, lighting candles, laying flowers to remember those who have passed away. What happened is truly, truly shocking and something that this community would take a while to recover from.
Simi Jalaosa, thank you.
It is just gone 6:15. Let's get some business news. And the boss of the UK's biggest gym operator says the government needs a more strategic relationship with business. Sean has more. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Simon. Yeah, I've been chatting to Clive Chesser, who runs the chain Pure Gym. It's got 450 sites across the UK, so the biggest gym business, both in terms of locations and members as well. Previously, interestingly, chief executive of the pub chain Punch Taverns as well. He told me his business, he thought, was well placed to help the NHS, particularly when it came to reducing inactivity levels. We talked about the need, as he saw it, for the government to shift the tax burden more as well onto online retailers, something that's popped up a few times in conversations with bosses lately. First, he told me about the origins of Pure Gym. Started life 18 years ago in Leeds.
Initially, you know, Pure Gym was taking a fitness product for actually incredible value to a world where fitness was quite inaccessible. A gym membership was quite expensive, and it was also not entirely straightforward. You had to go to the gym, you had to sort of set up your membership in person. It was quite difficult to leave. We absolutely turned that on its head. It's easy to join Pure Gym. It's also easy to leave Pure Gym, and then it's easy to rejoin Pure Gym. And we think about our members as being either active or inactive at any time. Most of our joiners, in fact, are previous members. So you're right.
Have you seen an increase in people using that facility? People thinking, this month or this period of months, I don't need to subscribe effectively, and then returning back. Are there more people bouncing in and out than there were?
You'd probably be surprised at the average length of tenure of a membership is way beyond 12 months. It's actually about 19 months. So most people stay for quite a long time, and lots of our members have been members for many years. But you're right that some people choose to come and go. They take a bit of time out of fitness for whatever reason, and we absolutely facilitate that. And that's particularly true with the younger generation. They are a little more transient in nature. We call it fitness snacking. They might go off and do some other fitness events. They might join a studio for a period of time. But we are there for them, and we provide that overall broad fitness proposition that they keep coming back to. And I was looking at the data, 47% of our joiners in January were 25 or under. So increasingly, this is a younger demographic coming into gyms, and it's fine.
What are the older demographics doing then, if it's not quite such a large proportion?
Importantly, they're still there. The real growth is in the younger demographic, but actually our older members, they're less transient. So the tenure with older members is longer. They tend to be less likely to leave for a period and come back, or to switch around. But the younger demographic are more transient. I think in everything they do, they're a little more transient.
Do you expect to have a closer relationship with the NHS in the years to come?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, what I'd love to see is a more joined up approach. We can really help. And one of the things that struck me actually since joining Pure Gym and joining the fitness sector is I think there is a lack of a joined up sort of partnership approach with the NHS. We have 456 gyms across the UK with, you know, lots of capacity and lots of space, and we've got incredible equipment, and it feels like we're able to help more than we do. In reality, you know, we kind of take matters into our own hands, and we support a lot of charitable initiatives, which I'm keen to talk about. But I'd love to see a more joined up strategic approach, actually with government more generally, in partnership with business. I think there's some missed opportunities here.
Where would you see that happening? How could a person's day-to-day, year-to-year association and dealings with the NHS be different and involve companies like yours?
Well, if you look at the 10-year NHS plan that was launched last year, well, there's some absolute merit in everything they're trying to achieve, and in particular, the move from sickness to preventative care. We can very much play a role in that. And there is a problem to be solved here, Sean. You know, we have a problem with inactivity in this country. 25% of adults in this country actually don't undertake any form of exercise. You know, the definition of that is moderate exercise for 30 minutes a week, and 25% of people are not doing that, and there is an obesity problem. And if you go further, 4 out of 5 adults are not meeting the recommended levels of activity. So there is a problem to be solved, and I don't think that the 10-year plan goes far enough in working through strategic ways to make people active.
Is the government speaking to you about this kind of thing?
I wouldn't say that the government is not speaking to us, but the government is not speaking to us coherently in a joined-up partnership approach enough, in my view. And we need to do more in that sense as well. And working with the industry body, UK Active, and the other big fitness companies, we're all very keen to do that. I've got a meeting in number 10 in a couple of weeks where we're putting forward some proposals, and we'll also tell them some of the things that we do.
What is going to be your main point to the government about how it goes about itself? Not even necessarily just about the 10-year NHS plan, but listening to what you have to say and businesses like yours have to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure to what degree they'll listen to what I've got to say, but my feeling is I'm very frustrated and disappointed, actually, that, you know, the Labour government, actually the Labour Party, haven't really been able to capitalise on their huge majority and build long-term strategic thinking that is absolutely getting behind what they talked about prior to coming into government, which was a growth agenda. I think that growth agenda, which we were promised, hasn't really yet made an appearance. In fact, what we've seen is more costs being layered onto running a business, especially, you know, in employment costs, and also really missing that opportunity. So business rates, for example, in the last budget, missing that opportunity to realign the taxation system in a strategic way away from bricks and mortar and high street businesses. We're a big high street business and retail parks, and we bring employment and we bring life and energy, literally, into local communities. And it's difficult and it's complicated, but that burden of tax has to shift away from bricks and mortar businesses, which, by the way, includes my old friends in the pub industry, as well as leisure more broadly, and needs to shift onto online retailers. And everyone knows that. And, you know, actually this government committed to replacing the business rate system and entirely reconstructing it. And we don't see any sign of that happening.
Why do you think that hasn't happened?
Well, I think, sadly, you know, this government hasn't been able to get on the front foot. I think it's disappointing that the Labour Party didn't get behind its leadership more in the early days and give it the space to build these strategic plans. You know, it feels like we're jumping from, well, for 10 years, actually, we've jumped between volatility to a crisis, and, you know, the government seems to be, you know, permanently in crisis mode. And, you know, in the last few days, you know, all of the sort of infighting within the government is really frustrating because it stops the government doing what it's there to do, actually, which is to strategically grow the country in a positive way. And it appears to be struggling to be able to think in a long term basis. If you ran a business in the way that the country is run, it would be very challenging. So we're on Prime Minister number 6, I think, in the last 10 years. And, you know, who knows when we're going to be on to number 7. Yeah, that's more akin to running a football club than it is running a business. Businesses are planning permanently at least 5 years out. We have a rolling 5-year strategic plan. You know, my recruitment to come and run Pure Gym was very, very well planned. I spent a lot of time with the previous CEO. He now sits on the board as chair of the business. You know, continuity and strategic planning is a really important part of what we do. And the country is essentially, you know, the biggest company you could imagine. And we need the same level of strategic long-term planning with, you know, strategic partnerships with business. And you know, sadly, don't seem to be able to get to that.
In response to that, the Treasury told us that they're cutting business rates by 5p for high street businesses funded by higher bills for the top 1% most expensive properties. So meaning many big online warehouses now pay a 33% higher rate than small high street premises. You can hear plenty more from Clive Chesser, including how a cancer diagnosis persuaded him to move from the pub industry to the health and fitness industry in that latest episode of Big Boss Interview on BBC Sounds. go there for that. Stay here for Micah Curra, who is head of personal finance for digital pension consolidation firm PensionBee. Good morning to you, Micah.
Morning, Sean.
Another day, another headline of some AI tool being launched and share prices falling elsewhere. So this time, it's about a wealth management platform. So there's one altruist in the US that's launched a new tool to help financial advisors. And next thing you know, share prices in St. James's Place, the biggest wealth group here in the UK, falling by over 13%, affecting others as well. AJ Bell, Quilter Aberdeen.
Yes. I mean, up until now, investors have been very much focused on the upside of AI. What will be the productivity gains? Who will be the winners? But now the market is taking a more nuanced approach, and they are looking for the so-called losers and asking whether these tools could ultimately lead to potentially redundant business models. And shares have been dumped both in the UK and in the US in these traditional financial services groups that you would typically seek out if you were looking for an advisor's guidance on wealth management or tax issues. Now, do I think wealth management is a redundant business model? No, quite the opposite, really. And we saw something similar 10 years ago when everyone was excited about robo-advice, where platforms would use algorithms to create a diversified portfolio for you based on your risk tolerance, your goals, and your time horizon. And while the solution worked for those smaller investors with smaller pots, really what people wanted to do and see was that human interaction, the whites of someone's eyes, especially when your financial needs get more complex and your wealth grows. And as you near retirement, you don't want to run out of money when you draw down your pension. Inheritance tax is still a very thorny issue. And yeah, a good wealth manager can really add value.
It's all about the tools behind all of that, I guess, when people get that service that might well be changing. Can I ask you, Micah, sorry to interrupt you there, but just about the US economy. Got some numbers out on the jobs market there, seemed to surprise a few people.
Yes, very, very positive. The American economy added 130,000 jobs, double what analysts were expecting. This is vindication for Jay Powell. It shows that the Federal Reserve is right in not lowering interest rates as fast as President Donald Trump would like. And they ease fears about the health of the U.S. jobs market, because last year we did see a sharp slowdown. Companies were struggling with changes around tariff uncertainty, crackdown on immigration, and massive cuts to government spending.
Micah, thank you. Micah Curry there from the pension firm PensionBee.
Thanks very much, Sean. I'll speak to you just after 7 o'clock when we get those GDP numbers for the fourth quarter of last year. Everyone will be looking at those very closely. In the meantime, let's get some sport with Delith and Nottingham Forest been wielding the axe.
They have, yes. Good morning, Simon. It all happened overnight, or very late last night anyway. Nottingham Forest have sacked manager Sean Dyche. It follows a 0-0 draw at home to bottom of the table Wolves. He's now the third manager the club has dismissed this season. Forest are currently 17th in the table, just 3 points above the relegation zone. Dyche spoke after the game before his sacking.
You've got to grow thick skin, and you've got to be reality bound, and I am reality bound. I can't remember over my 350 Premier League games, 351, someone just told me that I've made many excuses in my time. And I certainly can't remember blaming fans. It's my responsibility, simple as that. I take it on daily, I work very, very hard, as do my staff and as I expect of the players. That's all I can do, is keep working very, very hard until someone tells me different, if they choose to tell me different.
And Manchester City beat Fulham 3-0 to move to within 3 points of leaders Arsenal, who are away to Brentford tonight. Aston Villa remained third after beating Brighton 1-0. Liverpool became the first side to win at Sunderland this season. They also won 1-0. Crystal Palace, though, lost 3-2 after leading 2-0 at home to struggling Burnley. In the Scottish Premiership, Rangers could only manage a 1-1 draw away to 10-men Motherwell. It leaves them 5 points behind leaders Hearts, while Celtic won 2-1 at home to Livingston to move to within a point of Rangers. Arsenal look set to face Chelsea in the Women's Champions League quarterfinals after the Gunners eased to a 4-0 win at Leuven in their playoff first leg. At the T20 World Cup, England lost to the West Indies by 30 runs in their second group stage match. And at the Winter Olympics, Great Britain's Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson missed out on a podium finish in the figure skating ice dance event. It was after a disappointing performance in their free dance routine. Fear and Gibson finished seventh overall, meaning they failed to reach their goal of being the first British figure skaters in 32 years to win an Olympic medal.
When you don't perform the way you want to on any day, it's tough to take, but at the Olympic Games, it's even harder.
What do you think happened out there then?
Just a really costly technical mistake.
which was tough very early in the program because I knew that we kind of lost bronze at that point. But I also really wanted to not let the Olympic experience just disappear because of that. So it was this battle of like taking it in and doing my best the rest of the way while also knowing what I'd just done. It was costly and devastating.
Sarah Mulkerins with the question. Team GB still await their first medal at Milano Cortina. There's encouraging news in the curling, though, as Bruce Mowat recovered from mixed doubles disappointment as he led his Team GB men's rink to a 9-4 victory in their opening round robin match against China.
Thank you, Delith. 6:30.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Justin Webb and Jane Steele with the news.
An investigation by BBC News and the New Statesman magazine has found that at least 55 babies may have survived with better maternity care at an NHS trust. The deaths occurred over a five-year period at the University Hospital Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. In a statement, it said its mortality levels for the last 3 years were markedly below the national average and that it aimed to learn when things went wrong. The Prime Minister says the billionaire co-owner of Manchester United, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, should apologise for claiming the UK has been colonised by immigrants. Sir Keir Starmer said the comments made in a Sky News interview were offensive and wrong. The Reform UK leader, Nigel Farage, said that mass immigration had changed the character of many areas of Britain, something he said Labour was trying to ignore. President Trump says he has told Israel's prime minister that US negotiations will continue with Iran over its nuclear program. He said he would prefer a deal to military action. Mr. Trump's statement came at the end of talks with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Police in Canada have named the suspect in the fatal shooting of eight people in British Columbia as 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootseler, a biological male who identified as female. Most of the victims went to the school targeted in the attack. The suspect's mother and stepbrother were also found dead in a nearby residence. Jesse Van Rootseler died from a self-inflicted wound. New data shows that China's emissions of carbon dioxide fell in 2025, the first full year to show such a decline for the world's biggest polluter. Though the drop is just 0.3%, campaigners say it could be a critical milestone. 200 hospitality and leisure businesses are calling on ministers to abandon plans to allow a tax on overnight stays in England. They've written to the government as it consults on whether to give mayors and other local leaders permission to introduce a tourist tax or visitor levy to raise revenue for local services.
Thank you, Jane. 28 minutes to seven. Sir Jim Ratcliffe, billionaire businessman, part owner of Manchester United and resident of Monaco for tax purposes, has said the UK has been colonised by immigrants, comment that has got a fair amount of political reaction. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent, including from the Prime Minister, Henry.
Yeah, that's right, Simon. Jim Ratcliffe was giving this interview to Sky News. He said you can't have an economy with 9 million people on benefits and huge levels of immigrants coming in. I mean, the UK's been colonised. He went on to talk about the population of the UK increasing from 58 million people in 2020 to 70 million now. Just to be clear, Simon, that's wrong. The ONS estimated the population of the UK at 67 million in 2019, and it was about 70 million last year, so a smaller increase than Jim Ratcliffe was claiming over that period of time. Sir Keir Starmer responded. He said this was offensive and wrong. Britain is a proud, tolerant and diverse country. Jim Ratcliffe should apologise. And I think the easiest and simplest and best explanation for why Sir Keir Starmer said that, Simon, is that he fervently disagrees with Jim Ratcliffe. But I think also just worth noting a bit of a trend of a more punchy approach from the Prime Minister to very rich and prominent people with whom he disagrees. I think you can see this as part of the same trend as when he very happily had a big public fight with Elon Musk earlier this year over Grok AI as well.
A slightly different reaction from Nigel Farage, though.
Yeah, he said this country has undergone unprecedented mass immigration that has changed the character of many areas in the country. Labour may try and ignore that, but reform won't.
Yeah. Whilst we've got you, there's another high-profile departure this week from the number 10 team. We've obviously seen the head of PR, the head of communications, and we've seen other leavers. And also the cabinet secretary has gone this week. And just explain how important a role this is. It sits right at the interface, doesn't it, between the civil service and government?
Yeah, hugely important. I mean, physically, you see that. Chris Wormald, who is currently the cabinet secretary, sits there taking notes at cabinet next to the prime minister, but is also the head of the civil service, one of the big employers in this country. Now, you say he's gone, and we understand that he's gone, and everyone understands that he's gone, but it hasn't been formally confirmed, which is a bit curious. One of the other things that people generally understand to be the case is that he's going to be replaced by Antonia Romeo, currently the head of the Home Office. But interesting interview last night from Lord MacDonald, Simon MacDonald, the former head of the Foreign Office, who told Channel 4 News that he'd tried to warn Number 10 that they should run a proper process, that they shouldn't just give the job to Antonia Romeo. He said the due diligence needs to be thorough. If the candidate mentioned in the media is the one, the due diligence has some way still to go. Now, what he appears to have been referring to there is an investigation Antonia Romeo faced while she was Consul General in New York in 2017, when her boss actually was Simon MacDonald. A government source has told us that all the allegations were dismissed on the basis there was no case to answer. Interestingly, I've got hold of a letter that Kemi Badenoch is going to send the Civil Service Commissioner, Gisela Stewart, who oversees this appointment today, in which she calls on Gisela Stewart to formally tell the Prime Minister to conduct a full process for this appointment and also to delay any decision to dismiss Chris Wormald until the disclosure of the Peter Mandelson documents, which Parliament voted for last week. So I think this row may have some distance left to run, Simon.
OK. Henry, thank you. Henry Ziffman there, our chief political correspondent.
24 minutes to 7 is the time. A highly potent synthetic drug called nitazine has been linked to hundreds of recent deaths in the UK. Naftar Jahal is our correspondent, who's on the line now. What are these drugs, and what are they being created here or smuggled into the country? What's going on?
Yes, Justin, nitazines are made in a lab. They can be hundreds of times stronger than heroin, and even a tiny amount, about as much as a grain of salt, can be fatal. Now, according to the National Crime Agency, they're predominantly being made in Chinese labs, and drug dealers are smuggling them here via the post. They're cheap to make, they're hard to detect, and initially, when my producer Alex Homer and I first started looking into this issue 2.5 years ago, they were being found largely in heroin. But in the last few years, they've emerged in illegally sold fake prescription medicines like oxycodone and benzodiazepine. As one expert told me, this is now no longer a heroin user's problem, it's an anyone who uses counterfeit medicines problem.
And it's also people who, when they take a drug, do not know that this compound is inside the drug. In other words, that they don't realise the dangers that they're running.
Yes, precisely. In fact, that seems to be the case in almost all cases where nitazines have been found in toxicology samples. In fact, we have data which we've got our hands on, exclusive data from all available inquest records of almost 300 deaths linked to nitazines up to March 2025 in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. And it shows nearly every death was deemed an accident. It also shows that the youngest victim of nitazines in the UK was just 17, and that the Birmingham and Solihull coroner area saw more nitazine-related deaths than anywhere else. Now, that could be down to a spike in deaths among heroin users a few years ago in the city and efficient testing in Birmingham's toxicology lab. But more broadly, according to the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which is a panel of experts and former world leaders, the sheer number of deaths in the UK makes it a global hotspot. They say more people here have died of nitazines than anywhere else in Europe.
Now, you will ask why that
is being done. Well, there are a couple of reasons. One could be that we have very efficient testing labs and toxicology labs here. We have been testing for nitazines for the last few years, so in that sense we are ahead of other European nations. But also, the number of drug-related deaths has been increasing year on year now for several years. So the number of deaths related to nitazines, perhaps in that context, shouldn't be too much of a surprise. Now, you'll ask, Justin, naturally, what is being done about this? And in a statement, the Department of Health and Social Care has told us, it says it's confronting this threat of synthetic drugs head-on, working closely with health services and policing partners, and they said that strengthening border security is a vital part of the strategy. But if you speak to experts and charities, they're also asking to widen the availability of the overdose medication naloxone, which is life-saving, and to open more drug testing facilities. But frankly, there's no quick fix to what is an evolving and indiscriminate danger.
Natasha Harp, thank you.
It is nearly 20 to 7. There are elections in Bangladesh. Bangladesh goes to the polls for a general election. Yogita Limai is our correspondent there. And Yogita, there's been a caretaker government for the last couple of years in Bangladesh.
That's right. There's been a caretaker government in Bangladesh after a mass student uprising ousted this country's longest-serving Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, back in 2024. And this is the first election since then. I've covered elections in the past under Sheikh Hasina, and I can tell you this time around the environment in the city, in the polling center where I'm at, completely different. In the past, I remember when you drove around the city, you would only see campaign material, posters and banners from Sheikh Hasina's Awami League party. At the polling booths, you'd only find polling agents from the Awami League. The atmosphere was quite restrictive. People were quite scared to come and speak to the press. It was very difficult, in fact, to get speak openly to anyone. This time around, starkly different. If you see, there's campaign material, posters, banners from different political parties, people coming out to polling booths in front of me. I can see crowds gathering. Crucially, of course, Sheikh Hasina's Awami League party has been banned from contesting this election, which does cast a shadow on the claims made by the interim government and the election commission that this is truly a credible, free and fair election. But I think one thing we can say is that for the first time in more than a decade, voters, when they come here, feel like they have an actual choice at the ballot, and the outcome cannot be predicted with certainty. I've been speaking to Naveen Murshid, who was a part of that uprising which ousted Sheikh Hasina.
I think the voter turnout. I think we are seeing people trickling in, not in thousands at a time, but a steady flow of people coming in. And the last time I voted and the last time I voted, we went into nearly empty voting centres. The core issue, I think, if we can boil it down to the fact that we've not had credible elections, that we want democracy, we do not want a repressive state. Hopefully these are the things that we can expect from the new government.
And Yogita, what are the mood that these elections will be conducted in? I noticed that the former house of the long-time ruler Sheikh Hasina was actually burned down a couple of days ago. What does that tell us about the atmosphere that's prevailing?
Well, so there have been incidents of violence that I would say that's not uncommon in Bangladesh during elections. But I'll just describe the scene I'm seeing in front of me, Simon. And it's quite, it's something I've not seen during elections here. It's like a festive atmosphere. There are families coming out together, taking photos, selfies, group pictures. It feels like neighbors who are coming out and just chit-chatting, having a bit of a chat. Nobody seems like they're in a hurry to go home. Of course, huge challenges for whoever becomes the next leader of this country. Inflation, very high. Food prices, particularly. People are worried about that. And of course, there are worries for minorities in this country, particularly Hindu minorities who were traditionally supporters of the Awami League, and they are worried about safety and security. So those are the big challenges in front of whoever becomes the next leader of this country.
Indeed. Yogita, thank you. Yogita Limai there in Bangladesh.
18 minutes to 7 is the time. It was a rowdy, noisy, scratchy PMQs yesterday in Parliament as Keir Starmer faced more questions about his judgment, as Alicia McCarthy reports.
Since his last PMQs, Keir Starmer had faced a turbulent week, with continuing rumblings from Labour MPs over his decision to appoint Peter Mandelson as UK ambassador to the US, despite knowing of his connection to convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. On top of that, the Scottish Labour leader Anas Sarwar had demanded the Prime Minister's resignation, while both his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, and Director of Communications, Tim Allen, had quit. So, Keir Starmer started with a joke at his own expense.
Mr Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues, and there's been quite a few of those this week. In addition to my duties in this House, I shall have further such meetings later today.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, began by citing something Keir Starmer had said when he was in opposition.
And I quote, "I never turn on my staff. When they make mistakes, I carry the can." What changed?
Keir Starmer said he had taken responsibility and apologised for the mistakes he'd made. And he defended his former chief of staff, who resigned over the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson.
Morgan McSweeney helped me change our party. Yeah. And helped me win a landslide election victory. Yeah. Which delivered for them the smallest Tory party in over 100 years. Yeah. And what's her great achievement? To make it even smaller.
But Kemi Badenoch reckoned the Peter Mandelson case wasn't an isolated incident.
A few weeks ago, he announced a peerage for one Matthew Doyle, his former director of communications. Immediately after that, the Sunday Times published on the front page that Doyle campaigned for a man charged with child sex offences. Yet despite the Prime Minister knowing this, he gave Doyle a job for life in the House of Lords anyway. Why?
Matthew Doyle has been suspended from the Labour Party. He's apologised for his past association with Sean Morton, a former Labour councillor who admitted possessing indecent images of children in 2017.
Mr Speaker, Matthew Doyle did not give a full account of his actions. And on Monday, I promised my party and my country there would be change. And yesterday I removed the whip from Matthew Doyle.
The Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, weighed in.
To appoint one paedophile supporter cannot be excused as misfortune. To appoint two shows a catastrophic lack of judgment.
A visibly angry Keir Starmer attacked the Lib Dems over their time in office in the coalition government.
People in this country, millions of people, have been let down for years and years and years. And one of the reasons was austerity, which his party supported. He should take accountability and take responsibility for what he has inflicted on this country.
To which Ed Davey replied,
Mr Speaker, I think I touched a raw nerve.
The SNP's Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, took up the baton.
Mr Speaker, if I've just listened to the Prime Minister correctly, he's essentially rolled the same pitch in relation to Matthew Doyle as he did with Peter Mandelson, that they weren't clear with him. He appears to be the most gullible former director of public prosecutions in history.
And he called on the Prime Minister to publish the advice he'd received before ennobling Matthew Doyle. Keir Starmer didn't promise to do that, telling the SNP leader he knew how the system worked. The last person to be called was the independent MP, Ayub Khan. He's one of the MPs for Birmingham, where there's been a bin strike going on for nearly 2 years. He also sits with the other independents on the very back row of the opposition benches, immediately behind Reform UK.
Rubbish is building up right beneath my very nose.
Labour and Conservative MPs burst out laughing. Even Reform's Richard Tice bounced in his seat at the joke.
Easy, Tiger!
Although one or two of his colleagues looked a little less amused. With enviable comic timing, Ayub Khan went on.
It's becoming a serious problem in Birmingham.
Ayub Khan called on the Prime Minister to intervene to get talks restarted. The Prime Minister agreed the rubbish situation did indeed need resolving.
Lisa McCarthy on Yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 13 minutes to seven. A healthy old age is now a luxury good. According to the health think tank, the King's Fund, who say as well that spending on health as a percentage of GDP has increased hugely, but not really brought us much in the way of longer lives. Sarah Woolnough is here, who's the chief executive of the King's Fund. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
That last point is a rather surprising one, even a shocking one, isn't it? So we spend more and more as a percentage of GDP. What do we get for it?
Yeah, well, I mean, over decades, of course, we have seen, and taking a longer term view, we have seen an increase in life expectancy. Health does buy us, a lot of good. But what we've seen over the last decade or so is this plateauing in life expectancy, and also a real worry about healthy life expectancy, which is now below the state pension age. We're a slight outlier versus some of our European counterparts, other wealthy countries, and it brings brings into sharp focus, are we spending money in the right place? And can we simply keep spending ever more money on health? We already spend, using OBR figures, about 8.3% of GDP, and that's projected to double over the next 50 years.
So if we're spending it in the wrong place, where is the right place? Where should we be thinking of spending the money that might make our older lives better?
Yeah. Well, this is often talked about, this idea of shifting from sickness to prevention. I mean, the government's talking about it
a
lot.
We have people on the programme in the last, I mean, I've been doing it for 17 years, endless people coming on and saying exactly what I think you're about to say. We never get there.
We never get there. So actually, this is a wake-up call. And the OBR, you know, their longer-term projections, we can't afford to spend 15% of our wealth on health, on a relatively narrow definition of health. I think that's the point. Because it crowds out spending on other things that contribute to health. We've talked about moving to prevention. We haven't really done it. And by that, I also mean quite a broad definition. What does it mean to create good health? Well, that's education, it's housing, it's being able to be active in your community.
Well, it's making us all wealthier, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And if you look at where we are with working age ill health, we've got 2.5 million people out of the workforce on ill health grounds, and we've got 3 million people in work with a long-term condition. So we need to take really seriously and I think get quite granular about shifting more money to preventative health or to things that will keep us healthy, that help create health. I think there is also something about citizens, the public, you know, having a different conversation. What is our responsibility to help maintain our health as we age? Many of us will live with multiple long-term conditions. Thanks to modern medicine, we can do that now. What role and responsibility do we have through digital innovation, through wearables and so on, to really think about helping maintain our own health rather than this huge amount of money going into the acute end of the NHS, which we know is not buying us much or as much as it could do.
Do you think the weight loss drugs, if they are widely taken in the next decade or so, might make a difference?
I think they will be part of a package alongside a whole host of other things. You know, we have been incredibly lucky. Medical innovation, be it cancer treatment, be it type 1 diabetes innovations, I mean, that is buying us a lot of health. That's all good. And if things like dementia, good dementia treatments come along, I'm sure we'll want to spend some of our national wealth on those. But I think we can't simply innovate our way or spend on ever more medical innovation. We all also must think about what it takes to create good health in the first
place. And there's also, as I say, right at the beginning, you've got this really striking line, a healthy old age is now a luxury good. The inequality side of this is important too, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, you know, as countries get wealthier, they do tend to spend more on health. So we're not an outlier in that sense, but we've got very, very deep inequalities. You know, we hear often about the discrepancy in life expectancy. And so if we're serious again about a healthier old age for everyone, that means paying attention to the social determinants, which we often talk about, but we don't often put hard cash there. And so that's not just health spending, that's spending on, you know, the environment that we all live in, spending on children and young people. You know, over a quarter of primary school children are leaving primary school obese. So we're storing up massive problems unless we think about tackle the food environment, the way we live, our housing and so on.
Sarah Woolnough, Chief Executive of the King's Fund. Thank you very much.
It is 7:07. China, which has become the factory of the world, many countries have reduced their own carbon emissions by basically outsourcing carbon-intensive industries to China. It's seen it become the world's biggest emitter of carbon dioxide, responsible for 30% of emissions. But new data suggests that Chinese emissions are now falling. So what could that mean for the rest of the world? John Lang is co-founder of Net Zero Tracker. This feels like quite a big moment, that the world's biggest emitter is actually seeing its carbon emissions fall.
Yes, Simon. Well, we know that what happens in China doesn't stay in China, so I think we can be cautiously optimistic. So China has deployed more solar in 2025 than the whole world did in 2015, and 50% of new cars sold there are already electric. So they're streets ahead in terms of clean energy, and the the crux of this is that their clean power deployment is now outpacing electricity demand growth. So the chemicals industry is still producing a lot of growth in emissions, but most of their other sectors are in decline, and that is really good news.
Yeah.
Because it's confirmed it will probably be the biggest milestone since the Paris Agreement was signed.
Okay, that's wow. You think it's the biggest moment since the Paris Agreement was signed?
Well, I've always talked about if China actually goes into decline, it's the holy grail of actually the start of the journey down to net zero. So I often think of it like we're at the top of a mountain. We've been at the top of that mountain for about 10 years. But finally, we can actually see the decline. And so if this is confirmed, now Carbon Brief are credible analysts, but we probably need the IEA and the global carbon budget to also confirm this, and also China's own government. But if we are at that, if we are steering down the decline of the mountain, that means we're at the start of the next chapter down to net zero.
And that's important, isn't it? Because as I said in the introduction, a lot of countries have outsourced a lot of their industrial processes to China. You know, for example, you know, lots of Western European countries who've seen their emissions fall has coincided with a certain amount of deindustrialization. So if what's going on in China does really reflect something that could be going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. And the other thing that China does is it exports its surplus clean energy to allow other developing emerging nations to leapfrog straight to clean power. So we're seeing
that in the form of turbines, solar panels, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And so we're actually seeing that in India. And so China often over delivers on its promises, and we can see that that's probably going to be the case if this data is confirmed. But China's obviously at the vanguard of the story, but there's also India that will soon surpass the US as the second biggest emitter. But China...
And still
China
uses a lot of coal, of course, in India, don't they? The thing is, we often hear these headlines about, you know, huge explosion in solar in China, but we also hear that they're commissioning and building lots of gas-fired or coal-fired power stations at the same time. How do we understand that? Are they as backup to the large amount of renewables they've got? And is that the sort of dirty secret that you can have lots of renewables, but you need some fossil fuel stuff to back it up?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So the way I think about China is it's one system, but there are two stories. So yes, it's the world's largest source of emissions, and it's still building coal, but it's also the largest force for the energy transition. So China takes an all-of-the-above approach to energy policy. So, and that's not going to change quickly. But the key here is that utilization, when it comes to coal, utilization matters much more than capacity. So yes, they're building more coal, but more renewables mean coal plants are running fewer hours. And that the data is actually saying that, and that's why these emissions are declining in its power sector.
And if there's one magic bullet that they've used, is it solar? What is the lesson for the rest of the world if they wanted to copy this?
Well, solar and batteries are the killer app. So I think when it comes to energy storage, last year they grew 75 gigawatts, which outpaced demand by about 20 gigawatts. So clean flexibility is replacing that fossil fuel peaking that we've been seeing over previous years. So it's really, really exciting. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay. An upbeat John Lang there, co-founder of Net Zero Tracker. Thanks for joining us this morning.
There will be a touching tale with an all-star cast on Radio 4 this weekend.
How well do we know anyone, especially ex-wives?
Three men, one woman, and a lifetime of memories.
I was married to her once too, so I know what you're going through.
A tale of grief and grievances.
Don't you think you owe me?
Owe you? What do you mean?
Well, you did steal my wife, George.
New drama starring Bill Paterson, Nicholas Leprevost, and Jonathan Pryce.
I'm so glad you haven't come to rake up the past, Ed, because that really would be quite pathetic.
I Remember You, this Saturday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's get some weather with Chris Fawkes. Hello again, Chris.
Hi, Simon. Dry and sunny weather. Not today, but I'm holding out hope for Saturday, with high pressure briefly bringing a break from the rain. Today, no break in store, though. It is going to be another cloudy day with outbreaks of rain for many areas of the UK. The rain should tend to ease off across parts of southwest England, South Wales later on this afternoon as the weather brightens up. You'll see some sunshine here and one or two showers, but otherwise cloudy and rain pretty much relentlessly through the day. There are still 82 flood warnings in force. The majority of these across Dorset, will Hertfordshire and Somerset, and probably little really overall change expected in those flood numbers as we go through the next few days. Across the far north of Scotland, we do have some colder air pushing in here. Sunshine and showers for Shetland, Orkney, the north of Highland Scotland and parts of the Hebrides as well. A few of those showers coming through wintry. We'll also see some sleet in the hills of Scotland and the hills of northern England today. Otherwise, it's cloudy and wet. Cold wind for East Scotland, northeast England, gusting into the 30s of miles an hour. And temperature-wise, we're looking at highs of around 4 to 6 for Scotland and Northern Ireland, but just 3 for Lerwick. 7 or 8 for Northern England and the Midlands, and a mild 10 to 12 for the south of England and southern parts of Wales. Overnight tonight, we're looking at further outbreaks of rain, but some hill snow affecting Scotland and Northern England. And I think we could be looking at some disruption across parts of County Down and North Yorkshire overnight, with 5 to 10 centimetres above 300 metres elevation, perhaps 15 centimetres in places. And we could see some of that snow get down to lower levels, bringing a few centimetres here and there. Tomorrow, rain and snow pushes its way southwards, turning colder for many parts of the UK, then drier for Saturday.
Chris, thank you. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Justin Webb.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of February. The headlines this morning: a BBC investigation has found that poor care at an NHS trust contributed to the deaths of at least 55 babies in 5 years. The Prime Minister has condemned comments by the Manchester United co-owner Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who said Britain had been colonised by immigrants. And China's annual carbon emissions have fallen for the first time, raising hopes among campaigners that they may have peaked.
Coming up in the next hour, the boss of Instagram has been in court to defend claims that the company is damaging the mental health of young people. We'll hear a report from the courtroom.
It was a really big day. There were some people who were actually camped out overnight in the rain outside of the courthouse in order to be able to get a spot.
We'll also be looking at why two employees of two of the biggest AI companies have resigned and issued public warnings about AI. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
An investigation by BBC News and the New Statesman magazine has found at least 55 babies may have survived if they'd received better maternity care at one of the largest hospital trusts in southeast England. The deaths occurred over a five-year period at the University Hospitals Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. The organisation, which runs hospitals in Brighton and West Sussex, says safe maternity care is its goal, but it didn't always get this right. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
The Trust's own internal assessments of the deaths over a five-year period from 2019 suggest that better care may have or was likely to have led to a different outcome in dozens of cases. A separate review of 9 stillbirths over an 8-month period from 2021 found opportunities were missed in every case. The Trust made clinical negligence payments of more than £34 million for maternity errors in 2024-25, the largest amount of any trust in England that year. BBC News and the New Statesman have also discovered that an independent investigation into maternity services at the Trust is to be expanded to cover at least 15 cases. In a statement, the University Hospital Sussex NHS Trust said their mortality levels for the last 3 years were markedly below the national average and that they aimed to learn when things went wrong.
Sir Keir Starmer has called on one of the UK's richest men, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, to apologise for saying the country has been colonised by immigrants. The Manchester United co-owner made the comments in an interview with Sky News. A Number 10 spokesperson said Sir Jim's words played into the hands of the people looking to divide the country. Our political correspondent Ben Wright reports.
It's not the first time Sir Jim Ratcliffe has waded into politics. An evangelist for Brexit, he then backed Labour at the last general election. But now the billionaire businessman who lives in the tax haven of Monaco has said politicians needed to do some difficult and unpopular things to get Britain back on track. And it's his comments on immigration which have ignited political reaction. He said the UK had been colonised by immigrants, remarks condemned by the Prime Minister. Sir Keir Starmer said they were offensive and wrong, and that Britain was a proud, tolerant and diverse country. But the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, who Sir Jim called an intelligent man with good intentions, said the country had undergone unprecedented mass immigration that had changed the character of many areas. Mr. Farage said Labour may try and ignore that, but Reform won't.
Figures just released by the Office for National Statistics show the UK's economy grew by 0.1% between last October and December. That's in line with what analysts had predicted for the final quarter of 2025. New figures show China's carbon dioxide emissions fell in 2025, the first full year to show such a decline. The analysis for the website Carbon Brief suggests the reduction is modest, just 0.3%, but campaigners say it raises hopes that emissions from the world's biggest polluter might be peaking ahead of schedule. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
This is not a dramatic breakthrough, but it means emissions from the world's manufacturing hub and second largest economy have now been flat or falling for almost 2 years. Carbon Brief's figures show a finely balanced picture. Emissions dropped across major sectors, including transport, power, cement and metals, but rose in the chemical industry. China also added more coal and gas-fired power capacity last year than in any year for a decade. The plants are intended to act as backup when wind and solar generation falls short, but are evidence that fossil fuels remain a key part of the country's energy system.
Police in Canada have identified the suspect in the fatal shooting of eight people in British Columbia as 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootseler, a biological male who identified as female. A teacher and five pupils aged 12 and 13 were killed at Tumbler Ridge Secondary School. The suspect's mother and stepbrother were found dead at the family home. Jesse Van Rootseler also died from a self-inflicted wound. President Donald Trump says he has told Israel's prime minister that US negotiations will continue with Iran because he would prefer a deal to military action. His statement came at the end of talks with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Our correspondent Lise Doucette is reporting from the Iranian capital, Tehran, on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international media organizations operating in Iran.
Both Iran and the United States say they want to keep talking. But Tehran insists some issues are not negotiable. That includes its ballistic missile program and its support for militias across the Middle East. Yesterday, at a rally marking the 47th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, President Masoud Pezeshkian said they would not yield to excessive demands. Iran wants the talks, at least for now, to focus only on its nuclear program. The president said they were ready for any verification that it was peaceful. No date has been set for a new round of discussions after last week's indirect talks were described as positive but made little real progress.
The government has announced that it will urgently provide new air defence missiles and systems worth more than £500 million to Ukraine to protect against Russian attacks. For the first time, this will include £150 million worth of equipment bought from the US as part of a NATO initiative. Queues have built up outside polling stations in Bangladesh, which is staging its first elections since the overthrow of the authoritarian Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in 2024. Her Awami League party has been banned from running. The Election Commission said close to 1 million police and troops have been deployed to maintain order. A review into the death of Constance Martin and Mark Gordon's baby has recommended that registered sex offenders be required to inform police or any new partners and report if they or their partner are pregnant. Baby Victoria's body was found in a shopping bag in Brighton in 2023 after her parents went on the run to avoid contact with social services. Martin and Gordon, who's a convicted rapist, were jailed for 14 years for gross negligence manslaughter. Lebu Diseko reports.
The review panel's chair, Sir David Holmes, said baby Victoria's death wasn't predictable, but her conception arguably was. Had authorities known earlier that her parents were expecting a fifth child, more could have been done to save the newborn. But Mark Gordon, a registered sex offender, wasn't required to share the details of his partner's pregnancy. That, said the review panel, should change, with those failing to do so facing a possible recall to prison. Constance Martin, who provided written responses to the panel, said that she delayed disclosing her pregnancy because she feared hospital staff would alert authorities who would then remove her baby. There's no legal duty to reveal a pregnancy. The government says it's strengthening information sharing between agencies to help identify and act on risks to children earlier.
The government is introducing legislation today to clamp down on foreign funding of political parties before the next general election. The Representation of the People Bill will also lower the voting age to 16 in all UK elections. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
While foreign nationals currently can't donate to British parties, they can make indirect contributions via their company if it's registered and doing business in the UK. The reforms will mean firms making political donations will be required to show that they have a genuine connection to the UK, including having headquarters here and being majority owned or controlled by UK citizens. They'll also have to demonstrate they've generated sufficient revenue to cover the donations they make. The legislation would also lower the voting age from 18 to 16 for all UK elections. The Conservatives said that in government they tightened the laws against foreign interference. The Lib Dems suggested our democracy was in crisis and that the measures didn't go far enough to fix this.
The American actor Bud Cort, best known for starring in the 1971 film Harold and Maude, has died aged 77. His role in the cult classic earned him nominations for a Golden Globe and a BAFTA. In later life, he appeared in popular TV series such as Arrested Development and Criminal Minds.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 9 minutes past seven. In the last few moments, we have learnt how the economy performed in the last 3 months of 2025, indeed for the full year of 2025. It was a period when we had a very late budget, if you remember, that put some personal and business economic decisions on hold. So what is the picture? What does it mean for the Chancellor? Let's speak to Liz McEwen, the ONS's Director of Economic Statistics. Good morning to you, Liz. Take us through the numbers for the quarter and for the year.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We've seen quarterly growth come in unchanged on the previous quarter at 0.1%. So the overall picture as 2025 drew to a close continued to be one of subdued growth. If we step further back and look at 2025 as a whole, as we now can do, the rate of growth across 2025 as a whole was 1.3%. That was up on the growth rate that we saw for 2024 as a whole, and we did see growth across all main sectors for 2025.
Okay, and it's actually slightly below the estimate that the OBR came up with. What's been pushing it up and or down?
So for the annual figures, services were the largest contributor to growth. We saw 13 of the 14 sectors and services grow in those annual figures. But if we zoom back down into the latest quarter, so that quarter four and how we ended the year, the notable thing there is that services, which are so often the driver of growth, and as we saw, were for the year as a whole, showed no growth in quarter four. Mm. And it's the first time we haven't seen quarterly growth in services in actually 2 years.
And you also, and obviously this is backward looking, most GDP data is, well, all of it is, but you also at the ONS, you're always asking questions in more up-to-date ways. What have you gathered so far this year and what is it telling you?
Yeah, so we don't forecast in ONS, but we do keep in touch with businesses. And every fortnight, some 10,000 businesses provide us with their latest insights. So what are they saying so far this year? They're still citing economic uncertainty as the greatest challenge affecting turnover. Although interesting to note that the proportion doing so did drop a little in January. And the other positive sign we're seeing is that there's some early signs of slightly more positive expectations for their businesses coming through from those surveys.
OK, and that's been reflected, I think, in some of the business confidence levels we've seen. Anything else that jumps out at you that we should note?
Well, so we did see that 0.1% growth for the quarter. What was actually behind that this quarter was manufacturing. That grew 0.9%. And we saw half of manufacturing sectors increase. On the other hand, construction widely reported the weakness in that sector. The striking thing this quarter is it had its largest fall in more than 4 years. And we also saw weakness both in new work and also repair and maintenance in the construction sector.
Okay.
So continued weakness there.
Okay, so weakness or no growth in services, weakness in construction, a bit of a bounce back in manufacturing. Thank you very much for that. Let's bring in Sean Farrington, our business presenter. Morning, Sean.
Now,
that's a bit lower than the estimates were for the year. And for a government that says growth is its number one priority, it's not much to get the pulse racing.
No, that word subdued is it may be a good one that has described the tone of a lot of particularly small businesses that we've been speaking to of late. Even though there might be a lot of natural optimism from entrepreneurs and chief executives, that feeling, whether it was the fallout from the budget of 2024 at the beginning of the year, or that uncertainty that perhaps has hit that services sector towards the end of the year when we didn't really know what was coming in a very late budget. Those construction figures as well, definitely in that sector. House builders have been saying that whether it was uncertainty, you know, for them policy wise, or uncertainty for lots of potential house buyers in the run up to that budget hitting them hard. So, yeah, interesting that, you know, when you look into the numbers and you see that there was that growth that was a slight improvement on the year before, businesses have wanted, haven't they, Simon? You've talked to plenty as well. They have wanted to just be able to just get on with it. There feels like there's sometimes an underlying confidence there waiting to come out, but they perhaps haven't been able to express it in recent times.
It's very interesting that you picked out the construction down 2.1% on the quarter. That really is poor, and that'll be a disappointment to the government as well, because, you know, they were talking about build, baby, build. We're going to relax planning rules. We want to get, you know, that was going to be a big engine of growth, but not so far.
There started to be a bit more frustration, I think, in the words from some of the bosses that we've spoken to in the construction and the house building sector in recent times, where, you know, at the beginning there were, of this government's time, they were definitely allowing them time to deliver their policies, to put them forward and then try and get them into action. But that hasn't come quick enough for many of them. Mm. And now that does seem to be getting to a point of, when is this going to start actually having an impact? 1.5 million homes being built by the end of the parliament just feels like an ever more distant figure. And these numbers, certainly the end of last year, backing up that lack of confidence.
OK, just to recap, for the quarter, 0.1% growth. For the year, 2025, 1.3% growth. We'll get the thoughts of Lord Jim O'Neill, former Goldman Sachs chief economist, who was a Treasury minister under David Cameron, just after 8 o'clock.
Time now, 7:15. Of course, one of the things we have been regularly told by the government is political stability helps get us growth. At the moment, we don't have that growth, as we've just been hearing. We also don't really have that stability, do we? Keir Starmer talking last night to the women Labour MPs who gathered together, peers as well, and urged him to appoint a woman to a powerful role in his cabinet. They were meeting, of course, in the wake of the Mandelson affair. Also, the ennobling of Matthew Doyle, although it was known that he'd campaigned for his friend while he was accused of child sex offences and wasn't even a Labour candidate in the election he was standing in. Let us talk to Rachel Maskell, the MP for York Central, who was at the meeting last night. Morning to you.
Morning.
Just on the Matthew Doyle point, first of all, could he have been prevented from being a peer?
It would appear that there was information about him, and that the Prime Minister said yesterday that he was less than candid with the truth. We obviously don't know that information, and apparently there would be a way of settling that matter. And I think it is important that we see the transparency over this appointment. But we've got to remember the House of Lords of recent times has been stuffed with political cronies. And we've seen that not only with Matthew Doyle, but also Baroness Mohn. And I think, you know, time up on the appointment system now to the House of Lords. One, we need transparency, but that serious reform of the upper chamber is really called for now. And I think we've set out, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown set out a process by which that could take place. And we need to ensure transparency, because it is an anomaly that peerages can be given and not removed. And I put forward a bill, the removal of titles bill, initially because of the association of my city with the Duke of York, to remove titles, whether from members of royalty, but also peerages as well, because we need more transparency, more openness, but more processes in order to deal with these kind of matters.
And if your bill were to go through, would it apply to Doyle and Mandelson?
Absolutely would, because I ensured that it covered those appointments to the House of Lords as well. And it maintained the power between the Crown and the state. But at the same time, it opened up that opportunity for a joint committee of Parliament to make a recommendation for a title to be removed, or indeed the monarch, or indeed the individual to relinquish their title.
Hand on heart, though, Ms. Maskell, what is your level of confidence that the government will now do, that Keir Starmer will now do, what you and other women Labour MPs want done?
Well, I think there was unity, what I would say, with women MPs across the parliamentary Labour Party. And when Harriet Harman speaks, my advice to the Prime Minister is to listen. She is an incredibly powerful advocate, but Harriet over the years has raised up a generation of daughters now in the parliamentary Labour Party. And I think what we want to see is a real change in culture in the parliamentary Labour Party. Of course, first set out by Martin Ford in that incredibly powerful report that he put forward, where he addressed issues around misogyny, racism and factionism within the Labour Party. That must be implemented in full. But moving on from that, it is important that we don't have these appointments being made without transparency and proper due process. And putting those processes in place is going to be really important, because we can't just replace one person with another. It's really got to be about fundamental reform. And the second thing I would say to the Prime Minister, he has got to recognise the talent within the parliamentary Labour Party and ensure all the players are on the pitch. What has happened over his premiership is that too many talented women have been put on the bench and sat there and ignored. And it's time everybody was included, because if we were, Labour would be an unstoppable force to transform our country.
Well, when you say they're ignored, ignored why, do you think?
Well, we know that at the heart there has been this factionalism, pejorative thinking.
But is it political? Sorry to interrupt, but is that political factionalism, or is it something else? Is it sexism or even misogyny?
Well, I think it cuts in so many different directions. You've got to ask why today Diane Abbott is not yet part of the parliamentary Labour Party suspended in the summer. Here is a black woman who has experienced so much discrimination. There should be curiosity and pace put behind her situation to bring her back in the fold. But she is somebody that has been left on the bench. And that's why I do believe we really need to change that culture fast to ensure that all the players are out and working hard for that success of Labour.
It sounds to me as if this idea that we should have a woman, I think it's, what is it, First Secretary of State, this vacant position that could now be filled by a woman, in a sense with an ability then to see what was going on in Number 10. You're saying, are you, that that's not enough?
Won't be enough, but it is would be a really positive start if you think we've got a male Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, to have a woman with that sole focus on thinking about the not only the culture in the Labour Party, but the policies ultimately which will transform people's lives across the country. And a woman driving that through would put a different perspective on everything the government does. So absolutely crucial to have a woman in that role driving the government objectives forward. So I would really welcome such a position.
Rachel Maskell, MP for York Central. Thank you very much.
Let's just return now to those comments from the billionaire businessman Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who said the UK has been colonised by immigrants, in his words. Comments that the Prime Minister has called offensive and wrong, and called upon Jim Ratcliffe to apologise. Now, as well as the boss of industrial giant Ineos, he's also part owner of Manchester United, whose squad leans heavily on overseas players. Asif Mahmood is co-founder and club secretary for the official Manchester United Muslim Supporters Club. Good morning to you, Asif. How do you feel when the co-owner of the club is making comments like that? Hello. I think we've lost Asif. We will try. We have him back. Asif, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened.
So 75% of the Manchester United team are overseas players. How do you feel when the co-owner of your club makes comments like this?
I'm very upset. I think there was quite a bit of shock between our membership base yesterday. It was not a comment we certainly expected from the owner of or co-owner of Manchester United. As well as the club players, we have a lot of staff at the club who come from different backgrounds, and I'm sure they weren't happy with the comments either.
I've seen in your statement you particularly object to the word colonised. Why is that so offensive to you?
I think it's a very strong word to use. When you think of the word colonisation, it comes with a lot of very strong meanings. We just feel that it wasn't the right word to use. We appreciate there are debates, legitimate debates around immigration, illegal immigration, but using words like that just add. They just stoke the flames. We've seen that kind of word used by the far right in describing same issue, and we just didn't expect that from the owner of Gorkona of Manchester United.
And what form would your, you know, your displeasure take? Are you calling for an apology? Would you boycott the games? I mean, what are your options?
Well, I think we'd like to see Sir Jim retract that statement or apologise. I think that would be the reasonable thing to do. We have reached out to the club for comment, and we're waiting to hear back from them. I wouldn't say that we have plans to take things further. Yeah, we have a good relationship with the club, and we're just giving them the opportunity to come back to us. I just want to emphasise as well, this isn't an issue just for Muslims, or this statement affects people from all different backgrounds. So we haven't tried to make it about ourselves. We just felt compelled to say something about it.
Mm-hmm. It would. I mean, the first team squad would look pretty skinny without overseas players. Do you think the manager should say something, Michael Carrick?
I don't know. I think Michael's got his job to do. I don't think he's directly said anything. He hasn't said anything, so I don't think there would be a need for Michael to say anything. I'm sure he will be asked in his next press conference. I think the right thing to do would be for senior members of the staff to say something. I mean, Omar Berada himself is an immigrant, and he's a CEO of Man United. Maybe he'd like to say something. I guess time will tell how the club will deal with it.
OK. All right. Thanks very much indeed, Asif Mahmood, the co-founder, club secretary of the official Manchester United Muslim Supporters Club.
24 minutes past seven. They're calling it a test case. Social media in the dock. The head of Instagram, the first to testify in a court in Los Angeles, in a lawsuit that alleges that Instagram and YouTube knew that their products were harmful for children. The case is being brought by parents whose children died, they say, as a result of things that were fed to them online. I've been talking to Sonia Sharp, who's legal affairs reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and started by setting out the background for the case.
This is the first in... There's really actually two groups, giant groups of lawsuits that are mostly parents, some young users, against social media companies. People have been trying for a really long time to pursue claims against social media and have kind of failed or faltered. But these claims have gotten further than any others. And there's one that's in the California state courts and another that's in the federal court system. And they're really running parallel. But this is the very first of what are called bellwether trials, right? So they're going to try for the very first time to test out to see if these legal theories that they've been operating on will actually work. And if they do, we could be looking at really significant damages that the companies could be, liable for. And that experts have told me would set a floor for then what others might seek in similar cases. And again, there are thousands of these cases.
Right. So the case has begun. Tell us what happened in court.
It took a while actually to get a jury together. But once all that started, we had openings Monday and Tuesday. And then today, Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, was on the stand, and it was a really big day. There were some people who were actually camped out overnight in the rain outside of the courthouse in order to be able to get a spot in the gallery.
And what was the defense that was offered, if indeed any defense was offered? What was the line of questioning, and what was the response?
My read of it actually is that, because a lot of people are looking ahead to Mark Zuckerberg will testify in this case in next week. Right. So many people are really kind of anticipating what he's going to say. Mosseri is obviously below on the food chain to Zuckerberg. And he's also very calm and cool on the stand. He's testified before Congress before, and he comes off as quite media trained. He's affable to a degree. I don't necessarily think that the plaintiff's lawyers in this case were trying to get a lot out of him. I think that they really were looking to put a lot of these internal documents that they've gotten through discovery in this case into the evidence record so that they can be part of what the jury considers when they ultimately deliberate. And so a lot of what they were doing today was actually just walking him through internal documents saying, hey, this is your email. Can you tell us about this, this part of the email? But it was also very combative. The lawyer got permission to treat this witness a little bit more, again, combatively than we normally see in court. He was able to ask leading questions. So we were hearing a lot more from the lawyers today than I would typically expect to see in court. And that was a lot of it, is that back and forth.
So in essence, if the case against the media companies, the social media companies, is that their algorithms are deliberately damaging, what is their defense of that? Do we know?
It depends a little on the specific, you know, because again, these are amalgamations of cases. So in this particular case, the heart of it is social media addiction. And so far, their lawyers have offered, and again, on the stand, Mazzeri offers a couple of defenses. Number one, social media addiction isn't real, right? That's kind of their line. They won't say it that bluntly, but that's what they say, is it's not really a real thing. And second of all, if it is real, then this particular plaintiff, this young woman, Kaylee, doesn't have it. So they're kind of holding both of those things in tandem, right? Another thing that I noticed on the stand today is, in addition to kind of saying, oh, we work really hard to keep kids safe, and of course that's our priority, and here are the things we did, there's a particular law that again has kept a lot of these cases from moving forward, and it's called Section 230. And the heart of Section 230 is that the platforms cannot be held responsible for what third parties put on the platform, right? So you or I or anybody else who posts, Instagram cannot be held liable in United States court for that, right? They were very clearly, when the defense was cross-examining Mr. Mazzeri on the stand, they were very, very clearly trying to put everything that the plaintiff's lawyer had brought up earlier in the day into that 230 bucket, where then it wouldn't be something that the jury could find for the plaintiff.
Sonia Sharp, legal affairs reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
29 minutes past seven. Let's get some sport with Delith. Morning, Delith.
A very good morning to you, Simon. Nottingham Forest are looking for their fourth manager of the season after sacking Sean Dyche. It follows a 0-0 draw at home to bottom of the table Wolves. There were wins for Manchester City, Aston Villa, Liverpool and Burnley in the Premier League. Rangers are 5 points off leaders Hearts in the Scottish Premiership after a 1-1 draw at Motherwell. Celtic beat Livingston. Now, Rugby League's new Super League season starts tonight with promoted side York Knights welcoming defending champions Hull Kingston Rovers. This year, the league has expanded from 12 to 14 clubs, with Bradford Bulls and Toulouse Olympique also going up. For York, however, it's their debut season in the top flight. I've been speaking to their head coach, Mark Applegarth, about his and the club's expectations and how different he thinks it'll be.
Oh, listen, there's definitely going to be a jumping standard. I think you'd have to be a bit naive to not think that, but you know, it's one that we've been after for a club for a few years now. You know, we've been banging the drum saying we want to be one of the top flight clubs in Super League, and we've now got that opportunity, and you know, we're just relishing it. We know there's going to be some twists and turns, a period of adaptation in certain things, whether that's, as I said, taking a club from a part-time operation to a full-time one, but you know, it's one we're fully embracing and one that we feel we'll nail and we'll belong on to.
Tell me about the squad, because I think there's, fair to say, a mix of perhaps experienced heads that have maybe come in, as well as young players as well.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think as the star signing this year, his biggest signing's Paul Vaughan. You know, for me, still one of the top performers in the league in his position. You know, absolute champion guy that sets the standard. And to answer your broader question, I think I felt a bit of a responsibility to give people a chance to play Super League that were crying out for that chance last year. Ultimately, they backed up what they were saying with the performances last year, and as a club I'm really, really proud that we can give some of them players a chance to step up and play in Super League. At the same time, you can't be too much in love and naive about things. There's a certain standard that you've got to hit, so we've been very shrewd in trying to recruit people that we feel have already hit that standard and drive that standard forward.
And clearly you all will want to be competitive as a club in every game you play, but will it ultimately be just about consolidating that first season in Super League?
You know, there's different people's going to give you different answers. My job as a coach is obviously to prepare a team to the best of my ability to try and get a win every week, and that's exactly what we'll be doing. You know, I'd love to sit here and tell you that we're going to be winning 20 games straight or whatever like we did last year. We both know that's not going to happen. The main thing for me is that we know that every single week we've left nothing out there. There's going to be some really great wins, some very tough losses, and we just got to keep a level head about things and make sure that we've progressed by the end of this year, and you know, we can move forward, you know, knowing that we've given everything that we've got.
And from what you know of the club as well, clearly you must believe they have the sustainability to stay in Super League. I know there's obviously the relatively new stadium as well in the city, isn't there? It's important, I suppose, that will be maybe almost a sellout pretty much every home game.
Yeah, I think that's got to be the target, hasn't it? And my job's to to make sure that we give the City a team that they're proud of, shall we say. And listen, we've got a burning ambition as a club, as an operation, to be the best. We know it's going to be a journey, but it's one that we fully want to embrace and relish. And York's an iconic city. It's a very affluent city with working class roots, but there's some major brands in the city, isn't there? And I think if we can play an attractive brand of rugby league and the City are proud to get behind us and them clubs want to get on board and them businesses, then it can only be good for not only us as a club, but the sport in general, can't it?
The York head coach Mark Applegarth there. Well, there's commentary of York Knights against Hull Kingston Rovers on Sports Extra and BBC Sounds this evening from 7:45.
Della, thank you.
Blades slicing through ice at an electrifying pace. Skis flying further than ever before. Curling stones sliding with breathtaking precision. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics. Watch live on BBC iPlayer.
Weather today is expected to be mostly cloudy with spells of showery rain, but a break in the cloud cannot be ruled out at times, it says here.
Hey-ho. Coming up, we're going to look at why two employees of two of the biggest AI companies have resigned and issued very ringing public warnings about the future of AI and what it might do to us all.
You're listening today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Simon Jack. And at 26 minutes to 8, Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Figures released by the Office for National Statistics show the UK's economy grew by 0.1% between last October and December, in line with the previous quarter. The ONS said that meant the growth rate for the whole of 2025 had been a subdued 1.3%. There was no growth in the service sector during the final quarter, the first time that's happened in 2 years. An investigation by the BBC and the New Statesman has found at least 55 babies in the south of England may have survived if they'd received better care from the University Hospital Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. The trust said safe maternity care was its goal, but it didn't always get this right. Sir Keir Starmer has called on the billionaire co-owner of Manchester United, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, to apologise over comments he made about immigration. The businessman told Sky News the country had been colonised by immigrants. The Reform UK leader Nigel Farage said that mass immigration had changed the character of many areas of Britain, something he said Labour was trying to ignore. New data shows that China's emissions of carbon dioxide fell last year. Although the drop is just 0.3%, 2025 is the first full year to show such a decline. Police in Canada say the suspect in the mass shooting which killed 8 people in British Columbia had a history of mental health issues. 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootsela shot dead 2 family members before killing 5 pupils and a teacher at a school. Police say the suspect was born a biological male but identified as a woman. President Trump says he has told Israel's prime minister that US negotiations will continue with Iran over its nuclear program. His statement came at the end of talks with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. The American actor Bud Cort has died at the age of 77. He appeared in more than 80 films and television series, but was best known for his role in the 1971 black comedy Harold and Maude.
Thank you, Jane. 24 minutes to 8. Abigail Fowler Miller was just 2 days old when she died following an emergency C-section. An inquest in 2023 found she would have lived longer if her mother had been admitted sooner to the Brighton Royal Sussex County Hospital. This morning we learned that 55 babies may have survived across several hospitals run by the trust responsible for that hospital in Brighton. An investigation there is underway, as well as a wider review into NHS maternity and neonatal services being conducted by Baroness Valerie Amos, Chair of the Maternity and Neonatal Investigation. She spoke to us in December.
What we are seeking to do is to come up with a set of national recommendations. Some of our families have been very, very clear to me. They feel very strongly that the only thing that will make a difference is the statutory public inquiry, that it's the only thing that will give them the accountability and justice that they are seeking. We are not that, but I do hope that we will be able to come up with some systemic changes that will mean that what we are continuing to see up and down the country will stop.
Well, we can speak now to Katie Fowler, whose two-day-old daughter, Abigail Fowler Miller, died. Katie and her partner, Rob Miller, are now coordinate a group of 15 families who all suffered poor maternity care. The group is called Truth for Our Babies, and Katie is on the line. Good morning to you, Katie. Could you just talk us through where things you felt went wrong for you and Abigail?
Good morning. So I went into labour exactly on my due date. We called the Royal Sussex Hospital to let them know that. And then later in the day, I experienced some bleeding, which we also told them about and were advised that it was probably normal and we should stay at home. We called again with similar concerns a little bit later on and had the same advice given to us. The fourth time that we called, I had become critically unwell. I was bleeding internally. Abigail was deprived of oxygen. And we were told at that point we should come into the hospital, but that there was no rush for us to get there. By the time I did arrive, I was in cardiac arrest, which meant Abigail had to be delivered in the reception area of the hospital. We both had to be resuscitated and put into induced comas. And I was brought out of my coma 2 days later to meet Abigail, which was also the day that she died.
And were you aware either that beforehand that the outcomes in previous years had been poor in this particular trust?
Wasn't. I was aware that they had had a CQC inspection. It was actually published the month before Abigail was born that downgraded care at the Royal Sussex to inadequate. And I remember reading that and thinking that is not good. But I was reassured, I think, by a quote in the article from the trust saying that they'd improved since they'd been inspected. So I wasn't concerned about giving birth in Brighton, and I really, really wish that I had known more and that I had been.
And what are you trying to?
Because it might have encouraged me to.
What would you have done differently?
I think if we had known more about the issues, we might just have pushed back a little bit harder. When we were told it was fine for us to stay at home, we might have insisted on going in. We had full trust in the staff. And we trusted that the advice we were being given was the right advice. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
And tell us a bit about the Truth for Our Babies group. How did you reach out to other people who'd been in this situation? What made you aware of each other's, I suppose, position and what had happened?
So my husband and I felt very strongly once we started to realise that there had been problems in our care. We felt that we couldn't be the only ones in that position. And so after Abigail's inquest, we did some interviews. And one of the reasons we did that was to see if there were other families out there. And a group contacted us, Truth for Our Babies contacted us. And we discovered there were, I think at that point, seven other families that had experienced the deaths of their babies in very similar circumstances to us.
We should say that Dr. Andy Heaps, the Chief Executive of University Hospitals Sussex NHS Foundation, says, I want to say directly that we did not always get this right. As Chief Executive, I take responsibility for that. I'm deeply sorry for the pain and distress that you, Katie, experienced. The trust, he said, is now fully recruited, having hired 40 more midwives. Wes Streeting has also said there will be a specific investigation into that trust. What more would you like to see?
What we want is for the trust to improve as much as it needs to ensure that everyone gets safe care there. We don't necessarily believe that they are at that point yet, based on the fact we've heard from families that lost their children as recently as last year. The other thing we want is accountability. We want the trust held to account for the failings that caused 55 babies to die.
What does that mean, held to account? Does that mean fined? Does that mean prosecuted? What does that mean?
It means for me, scrutinised and kind of... I want the systems looked at. I want the processes looked at. I want to understand what went wrong there that caused the care to become so unsafe. And I want that to be done publicly so that it can't happen again.
Well, Wes Streeting has declared an investigation there. In fact, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care told us it was actively working with families in Sussex to appoint a chair and agree terms of reference for this vital review. Do you have confidence that this investigation will give you the things that you've just outlined you need?
I have confidence that it would if it is led by Donna Rockenden. That is who we would like to lead the review. At the moment, she hasn't been appointed, and that's what we're working on at the moment, is trying to come to the point where she is leading the review.
Just why her?
Because we trust her. We know that she's done good work in other trusts.
Okay, well, we'll see. I just have to also say, the Trust was also told us in a right of reply, the Trust reported, put it to the latest data saying mortality rates reduced to 2 out of 1,000 births in October 2025, down from 3 in 1,000 in April 2024. They say throughout the last 3 years, the rate has been markedly below the national rate and is now less than half the level of the latest 2023 national benchmark. But our thanks there to Katie Fowler and her group, Trust for Our Babies.
17 minutes to 8 is the time. There's plenty of loose talk at the moment about the dangers and the benefits of artificial intelligence. But when the man in charge of the safeguards research team at one of the leading AI companies resigns and says the world is in peril, we probably ought to take notice. Let's talk to Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor. It's quite eye-catching, this, isn't it, Zoe?
It is. There are two opposing schools of thought among people who work in AI, and they're divided into two camps. They're informally known as the doomers and the boomers. So the doomers fear that the tech poses an existential threat, while the boomers think we should crack on as quickly as possible so that we get the maximum benefits of AI. And I suppose Mrinank Sharma, who's just quit Anthropic, has just outed himself here as a doomer. But as you say, the fact that he worked on AI safety does make it sound a lot more alarming. And also, he worked at a company called Anthropic, which is trying to present itself as one of the more responsible, ethical AI firms.
And he says, we appear to be approaching a threshold where our wisdom must grow in equal measure to our capacity to affect the world, lest we face the consequences. What is it exactly that he is talking about? What is it that he fears is going on that we're losing control of?
Well, he doesn't spell it out, does he? But if you talk to people who are concerned about the future involving AI, you know, they will paint a potentially very bleak picture where it takes over so much of our world that we are just not ready to live around it. You know, our jobs, our education, our government, our defence, it takes a view that the tech is going to infiltrate and take over absolutely everything that are the pillars of how society runs these days. And we're not really set up to know how to live with that. On the other hand, there are others who say it's only ever going to be a tool, just like all the other tools that we've learned to live with. And, you know, that we're not going to reach a point where it's going to be powerful enough to exterminate us. Mm. I mean, I wish I could give you the answer. I don't know whether he's right or not. There's certainly a lot of debate around it. There's a big summit happening in Delhi in India next week where all the tech leaders and indeed all the world leaders are getting together to talk about AI. It's the third in the series so far. The first was themed around safety, the second around action. This one's around impact. And I'll tell you this, Justin, one contact of mine is so worried that safety's been sort of put, you know, further and further down the agenda of these talks as time goes on, that they've decided not to attend.
Another really interesting resignation from someone who was involved, who's upset about ChatGPT taking advertising. But it's not just that, you know, she doesn't feel that's a good thing to do. It's because of what the advertising might do to the people who use ChatGPT.
So the decision of OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT to carry advertising, is very interesting, isn't it? Because here's a company that's had multiple billion dollars pumped into it, really on paper, you know, a company that's attracting a lot of investment, but it's not actually making any money. And it's going to have to start turning a profit at some point and starting to show that it can stand on its own two feet, if you like. We talk a lot, don't we, about the AI bubble and the idea that a lot of these companies have just been overvalued and there's going to be a bit of a market correction, I think is the term that gets used. So its decision to carry adverts in a way brings us back to a very traditional and safe world, doesn't it, of how the internet is funded, how social media is funded. You know, we are used to advertising as a model giving us a service for free, and in a way that makes it feel a bit more like a human tool that we understand a bit more, doesn't it?
Zoe, we've got to leave it there. Zoe Kleiman, thank you. Interesting that Mrinank Sharma, who Zoe was mentioning there, the first of those two resignations, is leaving, he says, to pursue a poetry degree.
13 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London.
Good morning. When I think back to my own educational journey, I was very lucky to have received a scholarship to do a PhD. Perhaps my parents would have found the money to pay for it, as a doctorate was their dream as well. But I didn't want them to bear any further costs for my education. And when my supervisor told me of the award, he said quite clearly, "Mona, we're delighted to offer you a scholarship, but it's your moral duty now to complete your PhD." I remember feeling very grateful and relieved. For a while, my future was secure. But today, when I look at higher education, I wonder whether we still believe that education is one of the most powerful investments a society can make. We've gradually reframed learning to see it less as a public good and more as a private investment that yields higher lifetime earnings. And while university student numbers have increased, for too many young people, financial debt has become normalized as part of the university experience. But the current controversy over the high cost of student loans isn't just about money. It's about fairness, opportunity, and the morality of a loan system which results in so many people feeling trapped in cycles of stress and financial burden. When loans shape career choices, delay home ownership, or starting a family, the promise of education starts to feel like a trap instead of a gift. Debt or borrowing money isn't inherently wrong from an Islamic perspective, but similar to so many religious traditions, unjust exploitative increase on loans, a debt that paralyzes, multiplies, and preys on vulnerability, these are seen as immoral. Financial systems where money grows simply because time passes, where the lender gains regardless of the borrower's struggle, can be a cruel way to combine education and money. The prophetic saying, "I seek refuge in God from sin and heavy debt," reflects a particular and rather haunting Islamic sentiment that the soul of the believer remains suspended because of his debt until it is paid off. Education is meant to be an opening which carries a quiet social promise that talent shouldn't be limited by birthplace or lack of opportunity. But for too many people, it begins with a contract that says, "Your future earnings already belong partly to the past." However it's funded, we should see higher education as an act of hope, a belief that a society rich in learning isn't simply more skilled, it's more thoughtful, creative, and more resilient. That hope, quiet, persistent, and transformative, may be its greatest lesson of all.
That was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London. It is 9 minutes, 10 minutes to 8.
Gordon Brown is on the warpath. Former Foreign Prime Minister has written a piece for the New Statesman in which he calls on the police to investigate Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor over new information in the Epstein files released in the US. He says he has been told privately that investigations related to the former prince did not properly check flights to and from Stansted Airport. The emails released by the US Department of Justice seem to show the airport being used by Epstein and others potentially to traffic women. Again, to be clear, the former prince has strongly denied any wrongdoing. Dame Vera Baird is on the line, chair of the Criminal Cases Review Commission, but of course formerly Victims Commissioner for England and Wales. Dame Vera, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you want the police to do?
Well, I think that they do need to take more interest in this. When I was the Victims Commissioner, I was quite concerned. You can imagine the state of mind. I am there to you know, ensure our state protects victims. It happens to be a monarchy, and on the face of it, there is strong suspicion that the then son of the monarchy, because of course it was when a late queen was arrived, offers some sort of threat to victims. So you're kind of in a slightly plonker position. You know, you're supposed to be doing this role, and here seems to be somebody who's, you know, flouting what you want to achieve. So I did raise some things. Possibly I just said, and I had a visit from the Metropolitan Police to explain to me that the events were really mainly abroad and there wasn't much to go on. At that time, of course, Andrew was saying the photograph of him in Maxwell's house with his arm around a Virginia Giuffre, as we now know it to be, was a fake, and he was with his children that night. And I appreciate that lots has changed about that. He sort of said he couldn't sweat as well, and then every newspaper had a picture of him sweating like mad in some nightclub. But that was then, and it's always niggled me that you know, that was left. But nonetheless, I appreciated what the police were saying. But now, of course, things have changed very radically. Firstly, Maxwell herself has said the photograph is real. And so we have a man who paid $4 million, was it? I don't know, an enormous amount of money. Somebody he said he'd never met. And here is the person who helped arrange him meeting it, saying actually he did, because the photograph is correct.
And then also, all the stuff. Well, also, yeah. the thing that Gordon Brown is talking about, yes, seems to be the use of Stansted Airport, yes, and the police not previously being interested in that.
Yeah, that is absolutely new to me. I read Gordon's article yesterday and thought that added hugely to the obligation, really, to start properly investigating this. The Lolita Express, as he describes it, coming in and out, there will be some records there, which it would be a start. And I mean, the other thing, of course, Virginia Giuffre has written a book in which she, you know, not graphically, but does well in detail describe how she was involved with Andrew. And, you know, what on earth is going on if a woman you've never met turns up sent by a man who's a convicted paedophile, and there you are with your arm around her? Stansted Records.
Just on the Stansted records,
things have changed, haven't they?
On the Stansted records, it's interesting, isn't it, that at some of these flights, the manifests just say female. They don't have names at all. And given all that we talk about all the time about trying to prevent trafficking and modern slavery, etc., etc., it's really striking, isn't it, that when private jets are involved, there hasn't historically been much interest in who's on them.
Well, that sounds to be right. I don't know a great deal about how records are intended to be kept, but if you're on a private jet, you seem to be in a fundamentally different place than if you're on a public aircraft. I would say that one further very important thing is that there is now a solicitor, isn't there, called Mr. Edwards, I think referred to in Gordon Brown's article, who says that he represents three women who were in fact abused in Britain by, let's call it, this system. So all of that, it seems to me, you know, reinforces the position I held when I was the victims commissioner, that it is time to investigate this, and that we look quite odd if we don't.
What role do you want the King, if any, to play in that? Because the King's made it plain, hasn't he, that he would be happy to cooperate with the police.
Yes.
Of course he would. Would you welcome him saying in public, for instance, that Andrew should testify to the Congressional Committee, who repeatedly ask him to?
I mean, I don't feel that I can kind of press him to do, you know, an exact thing of my, you know, of my decision making that I've prescribed as the way forward. He's made his attitude clear. If the police come to him, he'll talk. You know, his wife is very, very highly regarded in the violence against women and girls sector. She is a true stalwart in that area. And, you know, I have no doubt that there is, you know, the goodwill toward helping stop any wrongdoing that's happened and bring it to book in that family. I have no doubt of that at all.
Just a thought about impunity, because one of the things when you read the emails, you realise that this world that they were all part of, whether or not they were committing offences themselves, they all felt they were part of a world that was sort of immune from well, untouchable, actually. And as a former victims commissioner, it is going to play, isn't it, and already has in the United States, into what we used to regard as a bit of a conspiracy way of thinking, that somehow the rich could always get away with everything It turns out to be potentially true, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, the notion of this, you know, quite extensive group of really rich and powerful men coming together in, you know, different kind of formulations for the kind of event that, you know, appears to be depicted by Mandelson in his underpants standing next to a woman in a dressing gown, though I appreciate completely that Peter Mandelson denies any wrongdoing, does suggest that there was a freedom to have a kind of, you know, bordello evenings from time to time, and that nobody would split on anyone else because they were all in it together. And probably Epstein, who seems to have taken an enormous amount of photographs of people, you know, had a hold over them thereafter. So you're quite right. There seems to be immunity. And what on earth about the women who were there, who were treated like, you know, mechanical toys, were they not, for the pleasure of these men?
Dame
Vera. Who felt perfectly secure to do it.
Dame Vera, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Weather time with Chris Fawkes.
Thanks, Justin. And today it's a cloudy day with outbreaks of rain. No change there then. The rain's going to be really persistent for most parts of the UK, but there will be a few glimmers of sunshine at times for southeast England this morning. Later on this afternoon, southwest England, South Wales will brighten up with some sunny spells and an odd shower. And the far north of Scotland seeing something a bit brighter as well for the Hebrides, North Highland, Orkney and Shetland. Sunshine and showers here. Some of those showers will be wintry. As I say, for most of the UK, though, it is cloudy and wet today with persistent outbreaks of rain. It is cold enough to see the rain turn to sleet across the hills of Scotland and across some of the highest parts of northern England as well. A range of temperatures then, 4 to 6 Celsius for Scotland and Northern Ireland, but only 3 in Lerwick, 7s and 8s for northern England and the Midlands, a mild 10 to 12 for southern parts of both England and Wales. Overnight tonight, we've got further outbreaks of rain and some snow. Now, we're going to see some snow affecting parts of Scotland and northern England, particularly over the hills, where above 300 metres elevation, we could see 5 to 10, maybe even 15 centimetres of snow, bringing some localised disruption to some of the highest cross-Pennine routes. That's the latest.
Thanks very much, Chris. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Simon Jack.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of February. The headlines this morning: new figures show the economy expanded by just 0.1% in the last 3 months of 2025, ending a year of subdued growth. An investigation has found that the deaths of at least 55 babies in 5 years could have been avoided with better maternity care at an NHS trust. And the Prime Minister says the billionaire co-owner of Manchester United, Jim Ratcliffe, should apologise for claiming that the UK has been colonised by immigrants.
Also coming up in the next hour, does the UK have a problem with the drug group Nitazenes? Experts think so. We'll hear from them, as well as those who've lost loved ones to the opioids. And
it's the wrong trousers, Gromit, and they've gone wrong. Stop them, Gromit, stop them!
A new exhibition is celebrating 50 years of the animation studio Aardman. Its co-founder, Peter Lord, will join us live. The BBC News this morning is read by Jane Steele.
The UK economy grew by 0.1% in the final quarter of last year, according to figures released this morning by the Office for National Statistics. That's the same as the previous 3 months. Our business correspondent Theo Leggett reports.
The UK economy ended 2025 on a relatively subdued note. The services sector, often seen as a key driver of output, showed no growth at all during the quarter, the first time this had happened in 2 years, with some commentators suggesting uncertainty over what the late November budget would contain had weighed on businesses. There was growth in manufacturing, but the construction sector registered its worst quarterly performance in 4 years, with output shrinking by 2.1%. Liz McEwen is Director of Economic Statistics at the ONS.
The overall picture as 2025 drew to a close continued to be one of subdued growth. The rate of growth across 2025 as a whole was 1.3%. That was up on the growth rate that we saw for 2024 as a whole, and we did see growth across all main sectors for 2025.
Earlier this month, the Bank of England lowered its growth forecast for 2026 from 1.2% to 0.9%. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, insisted the government had the right plan to build a stronger and more stable economy.
An investigation by BBC News and the New Statesman magazine has found at least 55 babies might have survived if they had received better maternity care at one of the largest hospital trusts in southeast England. The deaths occurred over a five-year period at the University Hospital Sussex NHS Foundation Trust. The organisation, which runs hospitals in Brighton and West Sussex, said its goal was to provide safe maternity care, but that it didn't always get that right. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
The Trust's own internal assessments of the deaths over a five-year period from 2019 suggest that better care may have or was likely to have led to a different outcome in dozens of cases. A separate review of nine stillbirths over an eight-month period from 2021 found opportunities were missed in every case. The Trust made clinical negligence payments of more than £34 million for maternity errors in 2024-25, the largest amount of any trust in England that year. BBC News and the New Statesman have also discovered that an independent investigation into maternity services at the Trust is to be expanded to cover at least 15 cases. In a statement, the University Hospital Sussex NHS Trust said their mortality levels for the last 3 years were markedly below the national average and that they aimed to learn when things went wrong.
Katie Fowler's two-day-old daughter Abigail died after an emergency C-section at Brighton's Royal Sussex County Hospital and campaigns for a group of families who all suffered poor maternity care. She told us she was repeatedly advised to stay at home despite suffering bleeding in labour.
By the time I did arrive, I was in cardiac arrest, which meant Abigail had to be delivered in the reception area of the hospital. We both had to be resuscitated and put into induced comas. And I was brought out of my coma 2 days later to meet Abigail, which was also the day that she died.
Sir Keir Starmer has called on one of the UK's richest men, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, to apologise for saying the country has been colonised by immigrants. The Manchester United co-owner made the comments in an interview with Sky News. A Number 10 spokesperson said Sir Jim's words played into the hands of the people looking to divide the country. Our political correspondent Ben Wright reports.
It's not the first time Sir Jim Ratcliffe has waded into politics. An evangelist for Brexit, he then backed Labour at the last general election. But now the billionaire businessman who lives in the tax haven of Monaco has said politicians needed to do some difficult and unpopular things to get Britain back on track. And it's his comments on immigration which have ignited political reaction. He said the UK had been colonised by immigrants, remarks condemned by the Prime Minister. Sir Keir Starmer said they were offensive and wrong and that Britain was a proud, tolerant and diverse country. But the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, who Sir Jim called an intelligent man with good intentions, said the country had undergone unprecedented mass immigration that had changed the character of many areas. Mr Farage said Labour may try and ignore that, but Reform won't.
The Manchester United Muslim Supporters Club also said it was deeply concerned by Sir Jim's remarks, adding that the term colonised was not neutral. The group's co-founder Asif Mahmood told us he was very upset.
When you think of the word colonisation, we just feel that it wasn't the right word to use. We appreciate there are debates, legitimate debates around immigration, illegal immigration, but using words like that, they just stoked the flames. We've seen that kind of word used by the far right in describing same issue, and we just didn't expect that from the owner of Gorkona of Manchester United.
New figures show China's carbon dioxide emissions fell in 2025, the first full year to show such a decline. The analysis for the climate website Carbon Brief suggests the reduction is modest, just 0.3%, but campaigners say it raises hopes that emissions from the world's biggest polluter might have peaked. John Lang is the co-founder of Net Zero Tracker, which assesses climate targets. He says this could be the biggest milestone since the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015.
if China actually goes into decline, it's the holy grail of actually the start of the journey down to net zero. I often think of it like we're at the top of a mountain, and we've been at the top of that mountain for about 10 years. But finally, we can actually see the decline. And so if this is confirmed, we probably need the IEA and the global carbon budget to also confirm this. But if we are steering down the decline of the mountain, that means we're at the start of the next chapter down to net zero.
President Donald Trump says he has told Israel's prime minister that US negotiations will continue with Iran because he would prefer a deal to military action. His statement came at the end of talks with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Our correspondent Lise Doucette is reporting from the Iranian capital, Tehran, on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
Both Iran and the United States say they want to keep talking. But Tehran insists some issues are not negotiable. That includes its ballistic missile program and its support for militias across the Middle East. Yesterday, at a rally marking the 47th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, President Masoud Pezeshkian said they would not yield to excessive demands. Iran wants the talks, at least for now, to focus only on its nuclear program. The president said they were ready for any verification that it was peaceful. No date has been set for a new round of discussions after last week's indirect talks were described as positive but made little real progress.
The government has announced that it will urgently provide new air defence missiles and systems worth more than £500 million to Ukraine to protect against Russian attacks. For the first time, this will include £150 million worth of equipment bought from the US as part of a NATO initiative. BBC analysis shows that the NHS in England is doing more treatments and procedures, but not enough to match the number of new patients joining waiting lists. The NHS will release figures today covering the last year. Ministers say the waiting list has fallen thanks to the hard work of clinicians. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
BBC analysis shows that the number of patients who've completed NHS treatment is rising, but so is the total of new arrivals on the waiting list, which was higher at 21 million compared with 18 million treated over the 12 months to November. The Health Foundation think tank said it was good the NHS was treating more people, but this increase was outpaced by new referrals, and this showed the challenge meeting government waiting list targets. The Department of Health said the total waiting list had fallen more than 300,000 since July 2024, thanks to the hard work of clinicians. Some patients have been taken off the list, for example, those who no longer need treatment. Health think tanks have called for more clarity on the underlying trend.
The American actor Bud Cort, best known for starring in the 1971 film Harold and Maude, has died aged 77. His role in the cult classic earned him nominations for a Golden Globe and a BAFTA. In later life, he appeared in popular TV series such as Arrested Development and Criminal Minds. Football, Nottingham Forest have sacked Sean Dyche as head coach after less than 4 months in charge. Forest are just 3 points above the Premier League relegation zone with 12 games remaining. The club is now looking for its fourth manager this season. Dyche's predecessor, Ange Postecoglou, was fired 39 days after replacing Nuno Espirito Santo, who was sacked 3 matches into the season.
Thank you, Jane. 8:10. Economic growth is the number one mission of this government. The Prime Minister and the Chancellor have repeated that countless times. Growth creates jobs, improves lives, and crucially generates the tax revenue needed to fund public services. Without it, none of those things happen. To achieve this holy grail of growth, the government promised a business-friendly approach and political stability after years of chopping and changing of PMs, chancellors and business secretaries. But after two tax-raising budgets and a recent drama about the PM's own future, how does that sales pitch look today? In the last hour, we've got some new figures. The economy grew in the fourth quarter of last year by 0.1%. The normally strong services sector was completely flat at 0%, although manufacturing production was up 1.2%, but construction remained very weak, down 2.1%. So cast our eye over this, and to look at what the government may or may not be able to do to boost this growth, Lord Jim O'Neill, former Goldman Sachs chief economist who's advised Labour and the Conservatives in the past. Good morning to you, Lord O'Neill. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Simon.
Just looking at these numbers, I mean, it's not anything to set the pulse racing. Is this glass half full or is it half empty?
Well, I don't want to set the tone of your pretty spectacular build-up, but The most important thing, which your listeners need to understand, is because we get so much information these days, we've already had quite a lot of January data, especially for retail sales and the monthly purchasing managers index. And they're actually both surprisingly stronger than people expected. So, a lot of this data for Q4 is interesting in the scheme of the politics of the madness that's been going on. They're not that important. Now, and the other thing that I'd like to say also is that, yes, it was 0.1 on the quarter, but for the year it was 1.3%, which did turn out to be quite a bit higher than consensus expectations at the start. And of course, it is nowhere near strong enough or good enough to be impacting normal people, but it is actually better. And the absolute most important thing that you and I have talked about before, the underlying productivity of the economy is showing tentative signs of finally starting to improve.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of people say productivity is the thing that really is the magic source. It's the magic source.
It is.
And what do we put that down to? I mean, that has been in the doldrums for a long time. And if that is perking up, then that is good news.
So one has to be really careful about these things, despite how many endless decades I've spent looking at it. It might only be temporary because data jumps around, but this is controversial to consensus mood. As I said at the time, I'm not entirely sure that the move to make it more difficult for employers to think about employing labour versus capital wasn't anything actually other than sensible in the big picture. And certainly the data shows that despite all the complaints from employers, productivity has improved since that measure.
Are you saying there that but by making people more expensive, it means that people will trust less in labour and more in capital, so they will upgrade, automate, deploy AI?
I am sort of saying that, but I wouldn't express it quite so crudely. It makes employers think more carefully about when to add labour, and definitely makes them think about more AI and more general investment. And that's, when you really look at the past 25 years of this economy, that is what we have been desperately missing. Mm.
It's funny because when I talk to bosses with my business editor hat on, mm-hmm. and I've talked to pollsters about this as well, when people are asked, chief execs are asked about the economy as a whole, they can be pretty so-so about it. But when you ask them about their own business, they're actually much more upbeat. And if you add all those upbeat ones, you get to a different picture. And some of them say to me, actually, the big things are going in the right direction. Interest rates coming down, inflation's coming down. As you say, there's been a little tick up in productivity. So that sounds like a recipe for a glass half full.
I mean, I try to be pretty, I am an independent member of the House of Lords and I don't like to do favours to any political classes, but, it is a glass. It's more half full than it's been for quite some time. At least the data is showing that. Whether we maintain this momentum obviously depends, as always, on a very large number of things, including the government stability. And what I would really like to see them do is, again, I've talked to you guys about on air, is be more ambitious about their second rule and borrowing more to invest in multiplier long-term growth boosting investments, because that will help a lot of normal people actually believe it is all a bit more rather than just some sophisticated nonsense on Radio 4. Yeah.
Okay, you've talked about the fact, more half full than half empty, but you did also mention stability. How big a card is that? Because the government played that card, particularly with international investors, pretty strongly, saying, who you're going to be dealing with for the next 5 years. What's the jeopardy there?
Well, I think the bond market showed you that this week. We had a sort of one-hour meltdown on Monday, but as soon as it became clear that the PM wasn't going anywhere soon, and most importantly, the Chancellor was staying around and the fiscal rules, despite ways they might be better, have got a lot of credibility, the bond market came straight back. And, if you actually look at the past week in hindsight, somebody coming from another planet who had been asleep would say, well, what on earth was all the fuss about from a financial market perspective? So yes, of course, it's really important.
Yeah, and just one other thing, if I look at the front page of the Daily Telegraph this morning, saying Labour up for closer ties with Europe, it seems to be incontrovertible that things like trade with our biggest trading partner have fallen. To what extent is that become a very attractive option for a PM and Chancellor keen to promote growth? And what would be the political cost of that?
I mean, I think by default, given the political... I mean, I'm no political observer, but I'd guess, given the very clear evidence about how damaging it has been for UK trade and amongst the many reasons why growth is weaker, the appeal of this government to get closer and closer to Europe is blatantly obvious, and they should do.
OK. Lord O'Neill, Jim O'Neill, former Goldman Sachs chief economist and advisor to both Labour and Conservative governments in recent years. Thank you.
17 minutes past eight. That then is the growth picture. What about the other rows the government is embroiled in and indeed the fights that it is picking, the latest being with Sir Jim Ratcliffe over his view expressed in that interview on Sky News yesterday that immigrants were colonising Britain. I've been talking to our political editor Chris Mason. We began with the Jim Ratcliffe view and Keir Starmer's call for him to apologise.
It struck me just in last night that this was a, if you like, straightforward political row in which the various participants were more than happy to take part. So you have Sir Jim Ratcliffe saying something that is instantly going to provoke a response. Some people will wildly agree, some people will wildly disagree with his language and his outlook. You had Number 10 and the Prime Minister pretty much straight away offering a public view, calling on him to apologise, talking about the UK being a proud, tolerant and diverse country. You had Nigel Farage for Reform UK talking about the country undergoing, as he said, unprecedented mass immigration that has changed the character of many areas of the country. Labour may try to ignore that, but Reform won't. For me, after the last couple of weeks of the conversation at Westminster, it's a reminder of the salience of two, in particular, two issues, the whole question of benefits and the welfare state, and then also of immigration, so often issues that run so high up in opinion polls in terms of people's views around the country, in terms of what is important. A reminder to me of how there's been something of a distraction from issues like that in the last couple of weeks, given where the political and Westminster conversation has gone.
Mm. But, I mean, I suppose the point is this an argument that Labour want to have? Is it useful to them to have it, or the opposite?
I detect broadly they want to have this argument. The Prime Minister is absolutely, as articulated in that quote I read, of a firm view as to where views like this one expressed by Sir Jim sit in the Prime Minister's mind. Now, we've seen, haven't we, over the last year or so, the government wrestle with how it approaches, in particular, the issue of immigration, wanting to recognise its importance to many people, wanting to be seen to be tough, but at the same time wanting to articulate it in a language that they would see to be moderate and compassionate. And you wonder how now, in this latest iteration of Keir Starmer, no longer with Morgan McSweeney, his former chief of staff, by his side, how that might calibrate. You remember that whole row about the island of strangers, that language that the Prime Minister used and then decided that he didn't agree with. Does his language change? Does his stance begin to change in the coming months? I think that'll be an interesting one to watch, particularly as you see an argument privately within the Labour Party about whether is there a shift from Keir Starmer to towards the left, towards the soft left, as he calibrates his response to what's happened over the last week politically.
Yeah, and talking of what has happened over the last week, this business of the peerage for Matthew Doyle is not yet settled, is it?
It isn't. And what we're witnessing this morning, Justin, is this curious spectacle of two men, both of whom have served as the Prime Minister's Director of Communications within the last year, on opposite sides of a public row over the controversial appointment of one of them to the House of Lords. Now, that tells you something about staff turnover in Number 10. To just look at the detail for a second, so Tim Allen, who was the Communications Chief until just a couple of days ago, he's put out a statement in which he says it was he who spoke to Lord Doyle about his connections to a sex offender before the now peer was offered his seat in the House of Lords. Here's that statement. He says, "The PM is right to state that Doyle did not tell me about his campaigning in a council by-election for Morton, the man in question. Doyle did, however, tell me that he had believed Morton's protestations of innocence prior to his conviction, and he had been supportive of him during that time." Now, I understand that Doyle had said that Morton told him that the photos had been sent anonymously by a political opponent, had been sent to entrap him, and that as a gay man, he had no interest in the content. Lord Doyle is also a gay man and had believed him, and hence that belief in Morton's innocence. I should say I've been in touch with Matthew Doyle. I've offered him a right to reply. He hasn't taken that up so far. He has said in an earlier statement that he acknowledges an error of judgment, he apologises, and that Morton's offences were vile.
But it is also the case, isn't it, that Keir Starmer is being told that he could have stopped Matthew Doyle becoming a peer. And the line from Downing Street has been that that process couldn't be stopped, but actually the suggestion is, yes, it could.
Yeah, so the key date in all of this is just after Christmas, tail end of December, when the Sunday Times published their report with a lot of this information in it. So could the government have acted there and then, i.e. in the window between the announcement of Lord Doyle's peerage and what's known as letters patent, which is the point where it becomes a thing? Now, the government was arguing yesterday, effectively, that it was too late in that window, that there was no precedent for doing that. Officials made it clear that, in their view, it's at the point of letters patents that you pass the point of no return, and so they could have acted then. It is also true to say that they could have made clear then that Matthew Doyle would not be in possession of the Labour whip. He wouldn't be a Labour peer at the point that he took up his peerage. They only made that announcement in withdrawing the whip just the other day.
That was Chris Mason talking to me earlier.
Now, do you remember Morph? Justin, I'm talking to you.
No.
OK.
That was a shocker. Never saw that coming.
The little plasticine.
I don't remember anything much. Okay.
Well, he was this little plasticine pal who was a sort of friend of Tony Hart's on that programme back in the day. And he started quite something.
Gromit. That's it. Cheese. We'll go somewhere where there's cheese.
Now, where were we? Places you find cheese. Lancashire, Cheddar, Wensleydale, Philadelphia, and Tesco's.
Chicken pies?
Yes, but I don't want to be a pie. I don't like gravy.
Well, that was Morph starting out there with Wallace and Gromit and Chicken Run following up. All productions of this animation legend, which is Aardman. More than a studio, you could argue now that it's a national treasure of a business, and Peter Lord is the co-creator of it and joins us on the line. Good morning to you, Peter Lord.
Good morning.
I've got such fond memories of Morph, I must say. The technology has come on a long way, although the style of the animation out of Aardman is still recognisably, you know, it's got a real brand to it.
It has, yeah. I mean, we still make, in my mind, handmade animation. You know, we have puppets which we manipulate by hand to make them come to life. But as you say, the technology has changed incredibly, but the fundamental thing that we do has stayed the same, and it's very precious to us.
Well, what is the fundamental thing you do? Because you give these animated characters real personality. I just wonder, what's the secret of that?
Oh, heaven, I mean, funny, good writing. Good jokes, good performance, just like, I suppose, like any comedy, frankly, you know, like, but except that our actors are small and made of plasticine,
much easier to manipulate than the real thing. I mean, have things like, you know, animation technology, things like AI, does that threaten, or you can embrace that? What does it mean?
Yeah, I think we can embrace it, you know. I mean, the fact is that technology has changed a lot over the last 50 years since we've been going. Technology keeps evolving, and we keep adapting and working with it and around it. So, AI doesn't terrify me, although I do watch it carefully, I think.
Take us back to the early days. How did this all start?
So there was two of us. me and Dave Sproxton, my chum, and we were at school together. We met when we were like 12, and we started animating as a hobby, an unusual hobby at that time, when we were about 16. And what we did was ridiculous, was not good, you know, not impressive at all. But it was, but for us, it was terribly exciting because we brought something to life, and that's the joy of animation. Mm. So when you do it, when we did it as school kids, if someone does it today, that process of creating a world and bringing it to some sort of life is very exciting and powerful. Mm. So we did that. And then we were lucky enough, our timing was good, and we got a little window in a TV program called Vision On, which
I remember
older listeners may recall. And that little window was our way of getting started. And what was a hobby gradually became, very slowly became a career, and then a lifetime.
Yeah. And what were your inspiration? Because, you know, there were people like, I'm thinking of the Wombles, Clangers, and then there was also, there was some Stop Nation, wasn't there? There was that guy Ray Harryhausen, who did the, you know, was it Clash of the Titans, things like that.
Yes, well, you've pretty well nailed it there, actually. It was those things like the Wombles and the Clangers that we aspired to, you know, as schoolboys. We thought that if we could make a series like The Clangers, we'd be home and dry. That would be it. And then Ray Harryhausen was an absolute a genius who brought monsters to life for like sci-fi and fantasy films. He was single-handedly, what he did was hundreds of people now achieve the same effect that he achieved on his own.
Okay,
so we watched those films like notably Jason and the Argonauts, and we were inspired by that.
Well, you've created some great classics of your own. I've got a feeling the Clangers and Morph would be able to understand each other. So,
they'd be fine.
They'd be fine with it. Peter Lord, co-creator of Aardman Animation Studio, and their exhibition is on from today at the Young V&A Museum in Bethnal Green, London.
28 minutes past eight to the sport. Here's Delith.
Morning, Justin. Nottingham Forest are looking for their fourth manager of the season after sacking Sean Dyche. It follows a 0-0 draw at home to bottom-of-the-table Wolves. There were wins last night for Manchester City, Aston Villa, Liverpool and Burnley. Rangers are 5 points off leaders Hearts in the Scottish Premiership after a 1-1 draw at Motherwell. Celtic beat Livingston. Now, at the Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina, Great Britain's Lila Fair and Lewis Gibson missed out on a podium finish in the figure skating ice dance event. It was after a disappointing performance in their free dance routine. The pair finished seventh overall. But encouraging news in curling as Bruce Mowat recovered from mixed doubles disappointment to lead his Team GB men's rink to a 9-4 victory in their opening round robin match against China. Let's speak to former curling world champion and Olympian Jackie Lockhart, who's in Cortina. Morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
So we know the men got off to a good start yesterday. They faced Sweden later in a rematch of the final from 4 years ago. They're world champions, number one in the world, very much the favourites. What pressure does that bring with it?
That brings a lot of pressure with it. I think if you're going into another world or the Europeans, you can cope with it. But the Olympics is a strange monster to play in. And I think it's probably all of the media hype and the fact that it only happens once every 4 years. So the guys have prepped for it. They've prepared for the last 4 years because they were so disappointed with only getting a silver in Beijing. So I've definitely got high hopes for them, but it's going to be a tough journey.
I'm intrigued as well by the fact that in the men's team, that there's a bit of a family affair going on. A few of them are related, aren't they?
There is. There's cousins in the rink. That's Grant Hardy and Hammy McMillan. Their grandfather actually had a hotel down in Stranraer, and he built a 4-seater ice rink, a curling rink, in his hotel. So the boys have grown up with the curling in their blood. Their parents played it, their grandparents played it, their friends at school played it, and they've been very, very successful. They're very good players.
And Bruce Mowat, who I mentioned, and Jen Dodds, they finished an agonising fourth in the mixed doubles event. You'll know how hard that is to come back from. How easy is it for them to forget that disappointment and move on to the separate men's and women's events?
Yeah, that is tough. And luckily for both of them, they had maybe 24 hours, 48 hours to park that disappointment. And I spoke to Jen, and she just needed some time on her own. She went for a walk, and she's got to reset her curling clock as such to be ready for the four-man or four-woman traditional game. And she seemed light-hearted last night and ready for the next challenge ahead. I think if sport is your profession, you've got to be able to cope with the defeats and try and rejig that into a positive to go to your next game. And they're good at that. They have to be.
And Jen Dodds, of course, is in the women's event, which gets underway later. Great Britain taking on China this evening. Team GB are the defending champions, Jackie. But of course, it's only Dodds that remains from the team that won gold 4 years ago. So an interesting dynamic there.
Yes, very much so. And Jen's still playing in a similar position down the rink, so she's not skipping the team either. But hopefully she'll have given the three other girls on the team the knowledge that she's gained from the last Olympics. Our Team GB girls are definitely underdogs. Mm. But having said that, they won the right to get here on their own. They're all very, very good players. And the Olympics is the Olympics, and absolutely anything can happen. They have the skills, they just need the consistency throughout the round robin stages to get to that past four.
We'll keep a close eye on it. Jackie, great to speak to you. Thank you so much, former world champion and Olympian Jackie Lockhart out in Cortina. Coverage of day six of the Winter Olympics is on BBC One right now, and starting shortly, the men's skeleton with Britain's Matt Weston and Marcus Wyatt in action in the qualifiers.
Thank you, Deleth. In Our Time is in half an hour. Here's Misha Glennie.
Good morning. 4,000 years ago, Hammurabi, king of Babylon, handed down his laws for Mesopotamia, just under 300 of them, to allow controlled retaliation, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, extending to murder, divorce, witchcraft and more. His laws are now celebrated as an early symbol of the urge for justice, and the laws themselves are preserved in cuneiform on a stunning black pillar now in the Louvre. Join me for The Code of Hammurabi with Francis Reynolds, Selena Wisnam and Martin Worthington on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now it's back to today.
And to the weather, which is going to be mostly cloudy again today. Spells of showery rain, but a chance of possible breaks in cloud in the afternoon. Cautiously written, but still there you go.
This is Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Simon Jack at 27 minutes to 9. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
New figures show the UK economy grew by 0.1% in the final quarter of 2025. For the year as a whole, the growth rate was a subdued 1.3%. The Economist, Lord Jim O'Neill, told us there were tentative signs that underlying productivity was improving. A BBC News and New Statesman investigation has found that 55 babies in the south of England might have survived had they received better NHS maternity care. University Hospital Sussex NHS Foundation Trust said safe maternity care was its goal, but it didn't always get this right. The Prime Minister says the co-owner of Manchester United, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, should apologise for saying the UK is being colonised by immigrants. Sir Keir Starmer condemned the comments as offensive and wrong. New figures show China's carbon dioxide emissions fell in 2025, the first full year to show such a decline. The analysis for the climate website Carbon Brief suggests the reduction is modest, but campaigners say it raises hopes that emissions from the world's biggest polluter might have peaked.
Thank you for that, Jane. 26 minutes to 9 is the time. Deaths caused by a synthetic opioid that is hundreds of times stronger than heroin may have been underestimated in the UK by up to a third. This according to research at King's College London. Nitazines are the class of synthetic opioids that are extremely potent and which we are talking about now. The National Crime Agency saying back in 2024 that they thought 333 fatalities across the UK were linked to the drug, but those researchers at King's College London saying actually the true number of deaths may have been underreported. And Dr. Caroline Copeland is here in the studio, who's director of the National Programme on Substance Use Mortality at King's College London. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What is happening? What's going on?
So the research that we have published this week has shown that under realistic post-mortem sample handling conditions, that the amount of nitazine is degrading in these samples to be below detectable levels. So the number of deaths that we're able to actually recognise as attributable to these substances is lower than what is likely the reality.
So people have the post-mortem saying they died of heroin overdose, of other
substances that are there. Other findings in the post-mortem and other causes that are attributed.
And that's partly because the amount of nitazine that you would need in your body to kill you is really tiny.
So they're very, very potent drugs. So you only need a very small amount to prove fatal. And if you've only got a small amount there to begin with, and then that's degrading even further, it's going to be below the sensitivity that the machines are able to pick up. The analogy I draw is like a greetings card on a scale at a self-service checkout. It's not that the card isn't there, it is. It's just it's so light that the machine isn't able to pick it up. And that's what's happening likely with these nitazines.
So when it comes to the number of deaths, what are you saying we are facing?
So if we are underestimating the number of deaths by up to a third, then the current strategies that are being designed aren't going to be sufficient to address the wider problem to actually be effective. So when we see reports of drug deaths continuing to rise year on year, as they have for the past 12 years, it's not really a surprise, because if we aren't able to see the full scale of the problem, then we're not going to be addressing it either.
How could we address it, though? Because if it is so tiny and it's synthetic... and it's here, what do we do?
So ideally we'd want to be able to detect that these people have these substances before it's killed them. And the best way to do that is to help those people to understand the substances that they're taking and to take them in a safer environment. You know, people are needing to use these drugs. They want to use these drugs. And if we can introduce wider drug checking services so they can see what's in the substances that they've purchased, and then introduce more overdose prevention centres like the Thistle in Glasgow that can provide supervision when these drugs are taken, that's the way that we can hopefully prevent some of these
deaths. Because often this is cut in, these nitazines are cut in with drugs, but the people taking the drugs don't know that it's there. That's the point.
Indeed. So in the majority of cases, they think they're taking heroin or Valium, which is diazepam. And so they don't know what a safe dose is going to look like. And they're not going to be taking the precautions of taking a very strong opioid. So they might not have naloxone, which is the antidote for an opioid overdose, to hand.
Yeah. And that we were hearing earlier in the programme is something that people are calling for that antidote to be much more widely available, because it could save lives.
Indeed. And it was widened last year for more people being able to get a naloxone prescription from community pharmacy services. So there are steps in the right direction.
So basically anyone who's taking heroin, or indeed the other drugs that you mentioned, anyone who's in that position should have access.
Ideally, not just them, but also their friends and families and associates, because if you've suffered from an opioid overdose, you're not going to be able to self-administer that naloxone. And so, you know, to have it as widely distributed amongst people as possible is ideal.
We were also hearing earlier in the programme it comes from China mainly at the moment.
The nitazines, yes. Not necessarily the naloxone. I'm sure some probably does. We have evidence from sources that a major producer of nitazines are clandestine laboratories in China. Although China does try to work to control these substances, they controlled the export of fentanyl and its precursors in 2021, I think it was. And over the summer of 2025, they've also done a generic ban on nitazines as well. If this will actually have an impact that we'll see fewer nitazines on the streets of the UK, I'm not sure, because these laboratories could move to other countries where they haven't yet been banned, or we could start seeing the appearance of other synthetic opioids. And we're already seeing some cases of a class of new synthetic opioids, which is orphines.
Dr. Caroline Copeland from King's College London, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yesterday was the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It's 47th. It happened, of course, back in 1979. It's a day that's always marked by the authorities. But how is it marked just weeks after the brutal put-down of anti-government protests? Lise Doucette is in Tehran. And Lise, amazing really to think that you have these pro-government shows of strength just weeks after the conflagration we saw with those protests.
Yes, it's been said many times before, but you really feel it when you're here in the country, that
Iran now stands at an absolutely consequential crossroads, and it is a country, a people, pulling in two directions. We were there yesterday to see these mass government pro-government rallies, the same streets and squares, some of them at least, that had been filled with the sounds of protests, including calls for an end to the clerical regime last month. Yesterday, they were filled with chants of supporting the Islamic Republic, chanting those signature slogans of the revolution, death to America and Israel. Really, these are the foot soldiers of the Islamic revolution. And it really was the government's rebuke to those who predicted that the regime was about to collapse. It is clear that the government has some support, but it's equally clear, and we heard it for ourselves, and it was really, really striking. And people who were listening to the program yesterday would have heard some of those voices on the Today program. We were really stunned by when we approached people just randomly at a very busy roundabout and just asked a very open question, what's the main worry on your mind? Without a television camera there, there was an outpouring of anger and grief. A woman breaking down immediately in tears, saying, what was so many young people were killed? What were their crimes? They weren't rioters. They weren't arms. Why did they have to die? And yesterday at the main rally, the president, Masoud Pezeshkian, was really striking that while he too called the protesters rioters, accused Britain and the United States of instigating the unrest, he did apologize to those protesters who were suffering from the economic crisis, saying the government is doing everything it can.
Mm. And I just, there was obviously that the threat of the use of force against Iran by the US, you've got the Armada still hanging around off the coast. And I just wonder whether what progress diplomacy is making, or whether people are bracing themselves for a more forceful intervention.
Yes, America's military might is positioned in the Arabian Sea. It does cast a long shadow over people here. They're very worried about another war. But yesterday, we heard President Trump saying that despite Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel's urging him to push Iran to a bigger deal, which includes ballistic missiles and its activities across the region, President Trump saying, I want to go for negotiations now. Military options are on the table. And those we see an intensification of diplomacy, but Iran is insisting for now that some issues are not negotiable. We're not going to talk about ballistic missiles, they say, but we will talk about our nuclear file. But we also won't give in to what they call these absolutist demands, zero to nuclear enrichment, which Iran doesn't regard as fair since it's part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So there is now a window for greater diplomacy, but it could close at any time.
Lise, thank you. Lise Doucette there, our chief international correspondent in the capital, Tehran, working on the condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. It's a restriction that applies to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
17 minutes to nine. You will be aware that it's been raining a lot. The question, of course, that arises from that is what to do with the water, how best to use it. We've got 80 flood warnings still in place across the country. Some places have received a year's worth of rain in a few days. How are they managing the water, the overspill, and what can we do with it usefully? Let us talk to Rachel Glossop, who's on the line, who's the flood risk manager for Hull City Council, part of the Living with Water Partnership. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Tell us about the Living with Water Partnership.
So Hull is quite a complex place in terms of flooding. We have every type of flooding you can imagine. The topography of the city is shaped like a bowl. So when the rain falls on the city, it's incredibly hard to get that water out. We also have several different authorities who are responsible for all different things. So we all came together, Yorkshire Water, Hull City Council, East Riding, Environment Agency and University of Hull, called ourselves the Living with Water Partnership and decided that as well as investing in new infrastructure, what we needed to do was really work with communities to build that level of personal resilience that people want and to get that understanding around water and how we manage it.
And in practical terms, then, what does it mean that you've done?
So what we've been doing is investing in what we call SUDS. So this is sustainable drainage systems. So they are above ground systems. They're nature-based solutions. It's things like swales, it's detention basins, ponds, reed beds, rainwater reharvesting. And then you get some below ground, which is filtered drains and permeable paving. But it's all about capturing the water at source. It's reusing the water. It's helping because it's holding water back. It's slowing the flow. You've got some water quality benefits because obviously vegetated solutions provide that filtration of the pollutants before it gets into the watercourses. You've also got a massive ecology and biodiversity benefit, and there's the amenity value there as well. So we've been retrofitting those across Hull and East Riding to really try and manage that water where it lands and just to reduce that risk of flooding to our communities.
The reusing part of it is interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people see all this rain and think, it's just going off into the ground or flooding. And being useless or worse than useless, but actually we regularly have water shortages as well in the summer, and we may have more of them in years to come, and there ought to be a way of somehow harnessing what is coming.
It, very much so, yes. I think, so as part of our Living With Water project, we also hand out water butts. So that's obviously a very sort of early start of that. But it's just trying to get people out of that mindset. I think for so many years, we've engineered our rivers, we've hidden our drains underground. So people just assume that it's someone else's problem. It runs off the roof of your property, it goes into a gully and it's gone. And we only take note of it when it obviously spills out and causes problems. So it's just about trying to manage it at source, above ground, which takes a bit of getting used to, because as I say, for so many years, we have just accepted that it goes underground. And it's just, like you say, trying to reuse. It was so frustrating last summer, obviously, when we had a drought. Some of our sustainable drainage that we put in, they were probably the only green areas in the city because obviously they were keeping the vegetation, the trees and things alive because they were actually the only sort of damp parts of the city. But I think we just need to really try and get our heads round, not trying to get rid of that water as fast as possible when it falls, but actually holding it back, reusing it, and just looking at it, learning to live with water again rather than learning to not live with water.
Rachel Glasser, flood risk manager for Hull City Council. Thank you.
It's 12 minutes to 9, and later this morning on Radio 4, Stuart Lee joins Armando Iannucci to examine the language around political psychodramas in Strong Message Here. That's at 9.45.
Now, legislation to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in the next general election begins its journey through Parliament today. If it passes, what is likely to happen? Alex Nerton is a member of the Youth Parliament. He told us how engaged people his age are with politics.
I obviously see young people who are really interested in politics with my work at Youth Parliament. I also take A-level politics, so a lot of my friends at school are political. But I'll still talk to people my age and they'll still be interested in politics, whether it's just reading the news or complaining about public transport. These are all political issues. And I think we want the right to vote for the same reason as everyone else. You know, we want a say in things that affect our lives. That's things at the present, like education, as well as, you know, things like university with tuition fees, social media, as we've seen recently in the news, but also things that are going to affect our future, things like climate change. That's disproportionately going to affect young people because just realistically, they're going to be around longest.
Let's talk to Professor Jane Green, who's Professor of Political Science and British Politics at the University of Oxford and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What do we know about the political opinions of young people and indeed the likelihood that if 16 and 17-year-olds get the vote, that they'll actually use it?
If we think about, let's think about the best evidence that we have. So we have survey evidence and polling evidence, and that repeats over time the following pattern. And that is the younger you are, on average, certainly in the last election and the elections before it, the more likely you were to vote for left parties or liberal parties. And so you see this very, very strong pattern of age and vote choice. And that suggests that younger voters, possibly 16 and 17 year olds, would likely follow that very strong pattern that we've seen in recent elections. So if you look at young women in particular, they tend to be the group that is most left-leaning, followed by young men. Now, this kind of runs contrary to, I think, some of the thoughts and some of the things that you hear online about the potential for, indeed, Reform UK to reach into the kind of very young voting group. So that's the pattern.
That's interesting.
Age and vote choice.
Just on that, before we go on to other things and the Reform UK thing, one of the experiences in America is that there's a real divide now, isn't there, between particularly young men and women. Young men skewing much more right than young women. Are you saying that that similar pattern can't be picked up here?
Absolutely. So the British Election Study, which we've helped to look after for some years, which is a post-election survey, very high quality data survey, representative sample after the election in 2024, showed that that pattern isn't emerging in the UK. And now that does run contrary to the US. It also runs contrary to patterns that we've seen in European countries. So, that's an interesting kind of distinction in the UK. And you asked about turnout as well. So we see that very clear distinction on age and vote choice. We also see in recent elections a very clear pattern of age and turnout. So older people being much more likely to turn out to vote than younger generations. Now, the challenge with extending the franchise to 16 and 17 year olds is that clearly those 16 and 17 year olds are going to need to decide who to vote for, and they're going to be doing that for the very first time, and they're going to be doing that in a more complicated context than was true in recent elections of old. So, figuring out how you're going to vote is kind of key to figuring out if you're going to vote. And so if we see that same pattern replicating of younger generations being less likely to vote, and if that happens for those first-time voters who are 16 and 17, then again, contrary to kind of perhaps some thinking in politics, the impact on the actual outcome could be indeed quite small.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? That people maybe get overexcited about what is potentially going to happen. And of course, we've had it for a bit in Scotland, haven't we, with 16 and 17-year-olds being able to vote. Has it made a difference? Do we know whether it made a difference there?
So it's really difficult to work out if it's made a difference on the outcome, and the evidence doesn't point towards a major effect. But it's one of these things that obviously needs to happen is if we're thinking about what could the effect be. It's not just a case of asking, did these voters vote and how did they vote? But, also, how are the political parties responding to this? So it could be that it might not have a big impact in Scotland. It could have a big impact here in the rest of the UK. But that obviously depends on whether or not parties are able to mobilise those voters and create that kind of effect. So if we're seeing, contexts where younger men in particular are voting more for the radical right, that's not happening here. Now, what would have to change for that to happen? And we are seeing loads of activity on social media. I have a 13-year-old and he's looking at this stuff. And, so he's going to have the franchise potentially come the next general election. So the parties, the Green Party and Reform are very active amongst younger voters on TikTok and so on.
And you think
so the question isn't like, we can't say this isn't going to have an effect. And just because it hasn't had a large effect somewhere, it couldn't have an effect elsewhere. But it's very much down to now the mobilisation of these voters and the education of these voters.
Yeah, and a cause and just being handed to them. And you think of student loans that we've been talking about recently on the programme and the unfairness, as many people perceive it, as what's happening there. Something like that could take fire, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things that we do see in our research is one of the kind of important changes over time is that younger generations are less likely to take the partisanship of their parents.
Right.
So if you think about kind of political socialisation, who do we learn from? It's not just those kind of hot button issues of student loans, but it's traditionally been, my parents have done this.
Professor, we've got to leave it there, I'm afraid, but that's fascinating stuff. Professor Jane Green.
Now, playing a musical instrument does an incredible array of physical and emotional things in your brain. It's a triumph of its function. But what is actually going on neurologically? Well, a neuroscientist, Theodore Zanto, and pianist Nicholas Namuradze got together to find out by connecting his brain to a light map. We connected Theodore and Zanto back together again.
Nicholas, how's it going?
I'm good, Ted. How are you?
Great. Good to hear from you.
Have you guys not met since the great experiment?
Yeah, we met last in November when we presented this in San Francisco, but we haven't met since then.
I wanted to get a better representation of what the brain looks like when a pianist is performing. I thought it'd be a really great way for us to help understand the complexities of the brain and how it unfolds over time.
And why is music and playing an instrument so helpful in that regard?
Well, playing music is an interesting phenomenon. It's a window into a lot of different complex cognitive processes, such as paying attention, remembering, motor execution, timing. And these are all core functions that are used in everyday life, and music is just a way to engage them all simultaneously.
Can you just describe what the viewer would have seen here? What was going on whilst Nicholas had his skull cap on, basically?
What they saw was essentially almost like a lava lamp in the brain. It's a cacophony of light and colors all moving and swirling together so that we could kind of get an estimate of how the brain communicates with itself.
So I played Bach's Prelude and Fugue in E major from the Well-Tempered Clavier Book 2. It wasn't a comfortable process, I will tell you that, because I was wearing basically a very tight swimming cap on my head for 9 hours a day straight with a lot of gel in my hair as well for the conductivity of the electrical signals. It was quite the marathon, literally and figuratively.
Was it fun, interesting, seeing your own brain and what your brain's doing whilst you're doing what you love?
It was fascinating. It was absolutely surreal. It was an extraordinary and very intimate portrait of my inner experience of playing this music. I played the second movement of Beethoven's Hammerklavier Sonata in B flat major, opus 106. I could see when I was getting emotionally involved, when I was doing a lot of thinking and planning, when I was very much trying to balance different voices and textures. When I was relaxing, you could see all of these parameters in how the brain looked.
Is this, you know, the motor skills of just hitting the keys? Is this the hearing of the notes? Is it the enjoyment? Is it the expression? What do you think you were actually watching?
Well, all of it. You know, that's the beautiful part of seeing the whole brain at the same time. That's the reason why we designed the glass brain at UCSF, is so that we could get a better understanding of what's happening in the whole organ at the same time.
I played Scriabin's second piano sonata in G sharp minor. It's opened up a whole new avenue of exploration, which is a very, very exciting new direction in our understanding of how the brain manages one of the most complex things that it can do, to play music and, in particular, the piano.
I suppose the question is, you're not going to feed this into some large language model and replace the likes of Nicholas with an